Academy Award-winning director Gavin Hood, Louder Than a Bomb's Jamila Woods, and from The Flower and Garden Show, Tony Abruscato. And now here's your host, a man whose bracket is already busted, Justin Kaufman.
I hijacked. I actually hacked the CBS site to just put write-ins. So Georgia State, Youngstown State, Indiana State, all lost. No, I couldn't do that. I wonder if you could do that. I'm sure you could. Some techies out there. No, my bracket is done. I'm already done. I think I had Baylor going to the Final Four. And mostly just because of those cool uniforms. Welcome to the download, everybody. I'm Justin Kaufman here on St. Patrick's Day. How dare Baylor lose wearing green on St. Patrick's Day, right? Broadcasting from Michigan Avenue in this beautiful city of Chicago. Glad to have you with us tonight. We got a great show lined up. We're with you till 11 o'clock. It's amazing. I don't even know where should we start. Scott Smith's here. Talk about the ever-changing landscape of Chicago media, whether it be the dust-up at Chicago Magazine or the news that Instagram is going to algorithm. No! Yes, the old, if you're an Instagram fan, that's you don't want to hear that news. They're essentially taking the Facebook feed approach where they'll select what you want to see. They know what you want instead of all the stuff just being there. So that's coming up here. We will talk about local media and some national stories as well. Tonight, we check in on some sports news. Of course, March Madness. What's up, Purdue? Come on. But also the weird spring training flap surrounding White Sox management and player Adam LaRoche. Did he really retire because he said he couldn't bring his, because Kenny Williams said he couldn't bring his kid to work? Is that really, really? Not to steal Seth and Amy. Really? Really? When I get high pitched, then you know I'm serious. Really? I don't buy it. Kevin Powell's in Arizona, and he'll join us with the spring training report. My guest tonight at the big table, Academy Award winning director Gavin Hood. His new film, Eye in the Sky, hitting Chicago this weekend. We'll talk to him about the modern warfare thriller, but also about his career in Hollywood and directing big-budget studio films. He did X-Men Wolverine. Eye in the Sky is also Alan Rickman's last film, so we'll talk with Gavin Hood about that experience. And much, much more tonight. Benjamin Dickinson grew up in Wheaton, and now his new film is hitting the Music Box in a great review in Red Eye today. We'll talk to him about his latest work, Creative Control, which is taking on a taboo subject, our addiction to our technology, our obsession with technology. And this weekend, two huge events, the final weekend for the Flower and Garden Show. And also we'll talk with them about young people in gardening. This is a big thing. Everyone I know is like, you know what? I'm going to get a garden. I'm like, what do you mean you're going to get a garden? Like where I grew up when I'm in Chicago, apartments and things, there's no garden. Now it's like, no, I'm going to tank that little spot in the alley. And next to the dumpster, I'm going to grow some eggplant. So we'll talk with the Flower and Garden Show about the phenomenon of getting young people involved in gardening. Also, C2E2. This is the weekend, guys. The Chicago Comic-Con is hitting McCormick Place. We'll talk about the phenomenon of adults dressing up like their favorite superheroes and villains. Cosplay, baby. We'll talk about that in the unofficial after party at Metro tomorrow night. And singer, songwriter, and poet Jamila Woods is stopping by and bringing one of the winners from tonight's Louder Than a Bomb Festival Indie Poet Competition. Jamila Woods is awesome. She does the hook on the Chance track Sunday Candy. Jamila will be in studio with us a little bit later in the show. News, weather, and traffic tonight with my man Rob Martier. Production provided by Pete Zimmerman. I'm Justin Kaufman, and this is The Download. All right. Well, let's get to the show. Let's start with the carryout. Carryout, of course, is a nightly segment where I read the newspaper, so you don't have to. Here are today's top stories. Happy St. Patrick's Day, and kudos to those who decided today is the day to party, not last weekend. That's the real deal, folks. Way to wear your big green hat and your tights to work today. Way to go, Irish. We are down to the final three candidates for the top cop job here in Chicago. It's a fire department guy and two outsiders, one from suburban Georgia and a woman from Spokane. Do we get to vote on this? I say homegrown. The outsider shtick? Nah, the last thing we need in a police chief is quotes like, the assailant was apprehended on Wabash Street.
Hey, this is news when nothing else is getting done in Springfield. Governor Bruce Rauner is now on Snapchat. What should we expect? Shirtless statehouse pics? Where he holds up the peace sign while wearing a flat-brim Yankees hat with the caption, "Check out these gubernatorial abs." I don't know about you guys, but I'm okay with my governor not being on Snapchat. It'd actually be better. In national news, Judge Merrick Garland was on Capitol Hill today to do the customary meeting with the Judiciary Committee. One problem, the GOP senators refused to meet with the SCOTUS nominee. They refused because they want the nomination to be done by the next president. And if it's Hillary, the next president. There are all sorts of precedent on this, right? I mean, I've read up just like you have. Democrats are kind of in a win-win here because if the GOP stalls, then they can use that against them in November. And if they nominate, well, they get a moderate judge on the court, which Democrats love moderate judges. Let's see how this plays out. Senators breaking ranks include Senator Mark Kirk here from Illinois, who believes Judge Garland should at least get a hearing. Why? Because he's running for election in November. SeaWorld says that they're going to stop their killer whale breeding program. So what does that mean? Like safe whale sex from here on out? That's gross. I'm sorry. I'm sorry for planting that image in your head. I'm sorry. Think of something else. La, 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 la. Donald Trump's hair. Donald Trump's hair. La, la, la. The old main Chicago post office is back on the block. The city wants to sell it to a New York investor. Great. You know what that means? They're just going to turn it into a huge Papaya King hot dog stand. Or maybe an original Ray's pizza. Or a bus terminal. Because that's really all I think about when I think about New York is bus terminals. They're everywhere. In weather, man, I remember coming downtown for St. Patrick's Day when I was in high school and it'd be like 30 degrees. Today, total bliss. You're welcome, Irish. In sports, March Madness. Oh my God, tell me the truth. How many matzo sticks have you had today? Put the poppers down. The night games are underway now. Big upsets today. Yale beat Baylor. I blame it on Baylor's uniforms. Oh my God, so blinding. It's like the Baylor squad is endorsed by the early 90s. Are their uniforms hypercolor? If you touch them, do they change to a different neon? Also, enough of Charles Barkley. I'm already done with Charles Barkley. The Bears were able to make a trade yesterday to dump Martellus Bennett. The black unicorn was pretty checked out last year. Actually, the last 2 years, really. And the Bears were going to cut him anyway, but instead, they dangled him to the Patriots and moved their sixth-round pick to a fourth-round pick. Doesn't seem like much, but a fourth-round pick usually starts. So you know what? Big win. I gotta say, I really like what the Bears are doing this offseason. Totally new team. The Hawks are starting to grab our attention with this little losing streak. Another loss last night has the faithful a little unsettled. It's less than a month till the playoffs, so we're getting a little itchy, but maybe it's a good thing. Get the losing out now. Although bad news, body injury for Corey Crawford. What's wrong with him? It's hockey, so the best you're gonna get is Corey Crawford's body hurts. For some reason, they can't tell you which part, but so use your imagination. On the other side, the Bulls lost big last night. Hard to figure this team out. And I got to say, I don't think they're going to make the playoffs. Is it possible this Bulls team misses Joakim Noah more than they think they do? I mean, really, we need Joakim and that crazy hair back on the court now. And finally, it's St. Patrick's Day today, so remember, drink responsibly. And what I mean by that is watch the clock, because you've been drinking since like 11 a.m., and it's now after 7. Maybe think about switching to water, or at least Coors Light. Well, that's the carryout for March 17th, 2016. In honor of St. Patty's Day, we're serving corned beef and cabbage shakes. Mmm, yummy. More to come tonight. Scott Smith here. We're going to talk Chicago media. A lot has changed in the last week. Chicago Magazine has a new editor. What does it all mean for you, the consumer? Also, Instagram turns to algorithms. I don't like it. More on the download. WGN, stay with us. Happy St. Patrick's Day, everybody. It's a download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, big week, I mean, big couple weeks here in Chicago media. You know, it's all been overshadowed. The news has been overshadowed by the election, and we haven't really had a chance to really sink our teeth into the new ownership of the Chicago Tribune, editorial changes, including Chicago Magazine, where we saw Beth Fenner
be let go and replaced by Susanna Homan, who was famously from Susanna's Night Out, who was running the Splash. I guess it's an insert. Is it a magazine over at Chicago Sun-Times? So she moves over. And we're going to talk about that. We're also going to talk about some movement in social media, the move towards the algorithm. Don't get me started, man. I get so angry. Scott Smith's here.
You just
here.
Like things to be the same, right?
No,
you're
I just
like settle in. You like
I don't.
Your, you like
I, don't
your
I don't want
fancy
Facebook
pictures.
And Instagram telling me what to look at.
All right.
And don't get me okay, we're getting out
All
of
right.
order.
Yeah.
You're already
Sorry.
Getting
I don't
riled
want to mess
up.
With your
Scott
system.
Smith has worked at a lot of different places here in Chicago. He's our new media contributor. Good to see you, Scott.
Good to see you, man.
All right, so let's talk about Michael Farrell and the Chicago Tribune. Obviously, you know, there was a lot made of him becoming the majority stakeholder at the Chicago Tribune, and he gave up his right. He put it into a trust for Chicago Sun-Times. But the big news this past week was the change-up at Chicago Magazine.
Right. So this was something that I think there had been some speculation about. You know, Michael Farrell is, I think, enjoys the familiar, if you will. You know, he's got, I think, some very specific ideas about how he thinks newspapers should be run. And they're based in his background in tech. So he's very big on, like, use data and, you know, use the technology to actually create more content and things mm-hmm. like that. But one of the other ideas that he has had is this idea of some kind of glossier magazines. And he tried to start the Grid at the Sun-Times to be their sort of business magazine. I think it was a good idea and perhaps not particularly well executed in the work that went in support of it. I thought the content was actually pretty good. The people behind it were actually great. One of the things that he sees as one of his successes is Splash, this sort of glossy magazine that's focused on fashion and style
celebrity.
Yeah,
right.
And
that's where there was a lot of dust up about Jenny McCarthy coming in. And
right.
I think Jim Belushi had a column at something point. But the idea of all that kind of, you know, coming to work for the Sun-Times, it was inside of Splash.
Right. So it was inside of Splash. You can still get, I think, Splash in some of the honor boxes and things like that around town. You know, it's pretty lightweight in terms of literally in terms of its page count, but also in terms of its content. It sort of plays as it's, you know, Susanna Homan came from Michigan Avenue, which was a much literally and,
magazine,
you know, content-wise, yeah. A weightier kind of look, but still very celeb-focused. She took that same kind of approach to Splash. The idea that Chicago Magazine, though, is, and I've seen this in a lot of the commentary since Beth was let go, that Chicago Magazine is somehow of the same ilk, that is a fashion and style and society magazine, may have been true a few years ago, mm-hmm. but, you know, I worked there for a couple of years, and I will say that the work that she and everyone else that's worked there has done to make the feature content that's in there, the big sort of weighty, you know, monthly stories.
She made a move, and that was a big deal. They moved towards more journalism,
yeah,
to more investigative pieces. We saw with Noah's work or Dave Bernstein's work.
Right. But they did something on the Mexican cartels that mm-hmm. run through Chicago. I mean, these were...
And cooking the books on the Chicago cops.
Right. I mean, these are national stories that originated in Chicago.
But truly, though, Chicago Magazine was created to be a service publication, wasn't it? I mean, the idea was it was a high society kind of top 50 doctors, you know, like it wasn't necessarily supposed to be where you go to get that kind of journalism. That's what we have newspapers for.
I mean, I don't know. I would disagree with that. I mean, back in the day, it was an offshoot of classical music listings. That's what it was originally supposed to be. The public radio station did that, and it's the name of it is escaping me at this point. But it evolved, you know, particularly in, I would say, the 80s into a pretty serious journalism organization. And, you know, you'd read some of the old stuff, and the stuff that was in there, I mean, I would go through the old, what they call the brown books, the archives, mm-hmm. and it was weighty stuff. I mean, it was on par with the kind of stuff that people laud, like the Roy Coe era and all that kind of stuff. So, you know, if anything, I think that we saw a bigger return to the journalism of it. And what people are saying right now is that, you know, this is now going to take Chicago Magazine sort of back to this idea of it just being a sort of North Shore, you know, style and fashion focused magazine, which we have a lot of. It's a very crowded.
Let me ask you this. I mean, I'm just playing devil's advocate for a second, because I mean, I have a lot of friends and people that worked at Chicago Magazine, you included, and you've done great work. But if the product is not profitable, meaning that, you know, they're running a deficit and they're not making money off of it. And you see things like Splash or other places where they're actually seeing ability to raise advertising or to do things because of the crossover potential with celebrity and style and what the internet does. That's what the internet does. Why wouldn't you, if you're Michael Farrell, move to that?
I can't speak to the, like, as of right now, what the financial situation is with Chicago Magazine. Yeah. But what I can say is, when I left, I know it was profitable. My understanding was when the former publisher, Rich Gamble, left, it was also very profitable. So, you know, very is, I guess, a, you know, relative term in publishing at this point. But it was not losing money. It was making money. So, you know, it was also, let's not forget, this is an award-winning magazine currently. And they got nominated for a bunch of the ASME Awards. So it's an award-winning magazine. It's producing some of the best journalism in the city. It's making some money. Why do you make a change at the top? It's because you come in with a particular idea about what, you know, the company that you've just bought is supposed to be about. And we're now seeing that with a lot of this other content that he's now kind of pushing into the digital properties of the Tribune, a lot of this kind of aggrego-driven content.
I think this is a really interesting time in journalism or the print journalism in Chicago, because you're seeing, you know, a newspaper that was once run by a rich guy who likes toys. Now he owns this newspaper.
Which rich guy are you talking about?
Michael
Farrell.
There's a few. But the idea that he can, I mean, it's so interesting to me that the value of these things is so low when it has been, you know, like think about the 90s. I mean, newspapers, you couldn't buy these things. Now he can go in. I mean, are we moving towards, in your estimation, a one newspaper town? I mean, is this the kind of thing where we essentially have, regardless of trusts and all this kind of stuff, or regardless of what's happening or being said at the Sun-Times, do you see Michael Farrell being the guy who's like, because right now he owns the Sun-Times, he owns the Reader,
right?
He owns the Chicago Tribune, and he owns Chicago Magazine.
And so right now, content from Aggrego, which is owned by Rapports, which he currently has this investment in a trust somewhere, that content is being also served out of the Tribune, and apparently the Tribune is eventually going to pay Aggrego for that privilege. You know, if you think back to it, a friend of mine pointed out to me this week, when Farrell was over at the Sun-Times, they sold the suburban papers to the Tribune for a particular amount of money,
right,
which then went to Farrell, which you could theoretically say he's using that money to then buy into the Tribune. For all intents and purposes, it certainly feels like a two-newspaper town, but the question is always, to me, it's always, what is the content, right? And we've seen, and last time I was here, we were talking about, you know, the Sun-Times as this blue-collar, working man, South and West Side paper. It has started to get back to that, and it has started to flex its muscles, particularly in the way that it talks about what the governor is up to and things like that. So to me, that's the key.
Now, that being said, you could still have one owner who owns all of it and says, that's my gritty blue-collar paper. That's my conservative suburban paper. That's my product that's going to be for celebrity stuff. This is going to be my product. I mean, you could see a media mogul in the making here. Maybe it's not a one-newspaper town, but it's a one-newspaper ownership town.
The Tribune distributes the Sun-Times. The Tribune distributes a lot of print content. I mean, again, this is the, for all intents and purposes, what do we mean by a two-newspaper town anymore? To me, it is, do you have a sense that you could lay, let's say, a couple of editorials, one, you know, a Tribune one here and a Sun-Times here, let's say a Reader one here. I don't think Splash does editorials, but like, could you lay them down and go, you know what, all of this is different. These are different voices. There is different, you know, columnists here. There are different voices being heard. There are different aesthetics. To me, that is the thing when we talk about being a two-newspaper town, that's the thing that matters the most. It worries me in terms of the economics of it, that the number of people who, you know, will have jobs here, the kind of media environment we support, you know, frankly, there's a whole lot of national stories right now. Flint, Wisconsin, you know, all kind of Missouri, all kinds of things happening right now that require a vibrant, if you will, Midwestern paper.
I would say past that. I mean, just in Chicago, the violence alone.
Right.
I mean, there's a lot to cover.
Charter schools here. You can go so
Springfield.
Into culture, Springfield, dining and food, what's happening
there's
here.
There's plenty. There should be no layoffs in media. There should be none.
Look, frankly, I would not be surprised if somebody sees this as an opportunity to create a new media company here because, frankly, there's a ton of opportunity if you have one person who is seemingly, you know, starting to cut into the true thing that differentiates a particular publication, I can see somebody saying, there's an opportunity here. It's time to step in. And there is, it's, you know, we can get advertisers because this place is, this particular publication is not going to be what it once was. There's an opportunity to do more here.
Scott Smith is our new media contributor. And we will be back because we need to take a break, come back and talk about Instagram. Gonna mess with my Instagram feed.
You're still gonna be able to fave stuff, so it's okay.
All right, 720 WGN. It's a download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. Scott Smith in studio with me, our new... It doesn't even work anymore. You've been doing this for a year. A new media... I like that. Like how it works, but the new media contributor. Before we get to my rant about Instagram, Governor Rauner, I mentioned this at the top of the show, Governor Rauner's on Snapchat?
Yeah, not actively, but he's on there. It's been 2 days.
Come on.
Did he make a deal of it?
He
added me back, though, as a friend. I thought that was cool of him.
Wait, so how, was this a press release? Where does this come from?
Is he touting this? I don't know. Touted would be putting it too. It was a political reporter said that he's on Snapchat right now. And he is there. Again, he added me back.
Is this something on the DL where he's like, I don't want anyone to know. I'm just doing some snaps.
So I don't know if this is how he's going to like get the info out. He famously does not like email.
Right.
So I don't know if this is his like, this is how I'm just going to do it this way. Yeah. You know, I'm just going to like selfie video. Like, this is my new thing. This is what I think of Mike Madigan, you know, like rainbows shooting out of his mouth and the laser eyes.
About to do press conference. Ching.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know if that's how he's going to do it. You know, I don't know if he's just feeling that it was a rough Tuesday. He's just like, I'm super into this, and now I don't know. Now it's going to be my first one. I got all this pressure.
I will say this, man. It drives me crazy. Politicians, you know, when they get on Facebook, when they get on Twitter, when they get on Instagram, you know, I mean, it's obviously run by their staff, but I mean, that's the death knell of any, like when you start seeing like all of your feed being politicians telling you about what they think about Springfield, you're like, oh man,
it's the joining Facebook version of right. You know, that, right? Like you're just like, oh, now
I think you should, what I need you to do next
that
time
guy
you come
my dad's
in,
office is here now.
I need you to monitor who's following Governor Rauner on Snapchat. That's what I want to see. Is it going to be a bunch of 18-year-olds like, cool? Like, who is it? Who's actually following?
He's just like, I'm having a lot of trouble getting, you know, support for what I'm trying to do with the budget. Going to go after the teens. Going to get them early. Yeah, exactly. Figure they'll get to the voting booth in like a year, and I'm set.
This math class sucks.
It's like a long yeah, right. It's like a long con. You know, he's just like, I'm going to put the time in. I'm going to build my community. And then I'm going to be set 4 years from now. I'm going to be A-OK.
All right. We got a couple minutes left for what I've been complaining about with Instagram. They've announced that they're going to go more to an algorithm like Facebook. So if you're an Instagram user right now, you pretty much have full access to every friend of yours that posts. It posts in a linear way down, scroll way down. So you get to see everybody's posts. They've decided they can do you one better. They're going to choose what you get to see.
Right. And then we've saw this recently with Twitter, right? They're now saying like while you were away and they sort of opting you into this idea that we're going to show you the tweets that we think you're going to like the most based on how often you interact with them and things like that. This is unfortunate with Instagram. Instagram is always like the calming place right. that I go, you know, it's like, it's very pretty. There's lots of pictures. It's kind of fun. It's the most relaxing of all the social networks.
Even though there's a lot of kids on it, it's very adult in the way that you follow your friends. You get to see what they're doing. There's no real need. You don't have to do anything.
I follow the Vermont Chamber of Commerce. They tweet out nice pictures of mountains. You know, it's a very zen experience for me, Justin.
That's good.
You know, so if they're going to show me lots of pictures of mountains and trees, like I'm all for it. But, you know, this, I don't know, this, we're used to this now, right? Like, yeah. I think at some point, you know, Twitter just made their announcement. There was a big to-do about it. Instagram has made this announcement that this is coming, and it was kind of tepid. It was not a huge outpouring of anger or whatever. I think we're now used to the idea that
Why do they do it? That's what I don't understand. I mean, are they doing it on Instagram for a monetary purpose?
This, to me, feels like, you know, when, you know, the places that own clubs close them and reconcept them, it's kind of like that. They know that, you know, a particular experience has a particular shelf life. You know, they can't keep the algorithm the same all the time because there are all kinds of factors, new kinds of content. I think Facebook, for example, just tweaked its algorithm to make sure that you see live video more. You know, so people are seeing that a lot more often. So they're trying to keep up with what they think people want, because the minute you stop feeling like this is fun or interesting or engaging in some way, you're going to go somewhere else, or you're going to stop using it, and that's death knell.
Again, they're trying to stop the one guy who will post 14 pictures in a row of the same landscape of his street.
Right.
You know, and then you're like, what are you doing? What is this?
Yeah, we're not for dinner. There's 14 pictures of the appetizer. It's potato skins. You know, can't figure out how to just post the one. Anyway, this is all of them. Had fun. You know. At Durbin's or whatever, the you know.
Yeah. Oh, who posts? Oh, Governor Rauner. Yeah. Great.
I'm waiting, man. I've been refreshing my Snapchat and, you know, expecting maybe he's like, talking about me, going to put it on now. No.
Big middle finger to Scott Smith.
Right. Right. That'd be cool. I'd be like, I made it.
And it's nice. It's drawn on with like
the one of people. The little scrawling thing, you know.
Scott Smith is our new media contributor here in the Download. He's on regularly. I'd like to have you more, but, you know, whenever you can get in here, that's great. I mean, it's St. Patrick's Day. I know why you're downtown.
Right. No, thanks for coming in here. I'm heading, you know, right over to Timothy O'Toole's.
You were at Jimmy O'Toole's, now you're going to Timmy O'Toole's.
Timothy O'Toole's and then Patrick O'Toole's right after that.
Scott, great to see you, man.
Good to see you.
Welcome back to The Download here on WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, a new movie hits theaters this weekend. It's called Eye in the Sky, and it stars Helen Mirren, Aaron Paul, and the late Alan Rickman. It's directed by Gavin Hood. The film is a war thriller that digs into the new world order, war by drones. But for every headline that flashes across your tweet deck about a drone strike killing wanted terrorists, there's plenty happening behind the scenes that you just don't know anything about. Gavin Hood won an Oscar for his film Tsotsi. It was for Best Foreign Film, and now he has 7 features under his belt, including X-Men Origins Wolverine, starring Hugh Jackman. The South African filmmaker, writer, and producer is here with me tonight in studio. It's a pleasure to have you here on The Download. Thanks for being here, Gavin.
Thank you so much for having me.
So, what drew you to this subject? I mean, you've done a lot of good versus evil in your career, but what about drones drew you to this movie?
Well, I think what's so great about this movie is it's in that gray zone. It's not quite good versus evil. Mm-hmm. It's to what extent, you know, is using a drone a force for good, and to what extent is it not, and what is the policy, what should the policy be? But what drew me to the project was just an excellent screenplay written by Guy Hibbert, which as I was reading it and I kept turning the pages was, on the one hand, this incredible thriller where I really wanted to know what was going to happen next and I was on the edge of my seat, and at the same time kept prodding me with different characters looking at this particular subject from different points of view, and I was getting like, what do I really think? And I got to the end and I felt like my head was going to explode, because not literally from a drone, but just because A, it was a really tense script, and B, I wanted to talk to somebody about what I'd read. I wanted to know if this drone technology was real. So I didn't have anyone to talk to, but I figured if I had that response, maybe an audience would have the same response.
Movie, yeah,
it might be a good movie for people to talk
about. Well, let me ask you, because one of the things I noticed is there's conflict abound. I mean, it's not sort of the straight, you know, good versus evil, like you said, or war and the mechanics of war. There's conflict between the operators and the drone. There's conflict between the states.
The politicians involved.
There's even conflict on the ground with how people are interacting and working around the actual spot where they want to have this drone attack.
Yeah.
So talk about that, because it seemed like that was a really complex way to do a movie with so much conflict at so many different levels.
Well, thanks. Yeah, if you ever wanted to know the whole picture of the drone program and see different points of view of it, I think Guy's script does that. So if drones are sort of mysterious to you, this will demystify them for you. The conflict is basically set up when 2 suicide bombers are discovered to be planning a suicide bombing in a house in Nairobi, Kenya, which if Nairobi is in a friendly country, Kenya is a friendly country. So it's not as if it's in Iraq or Afghanistan. And that appealed to me, because what happens as this war spills out, or this conflict spills out into friendly states or in our own country, you're in the strange intersection between warfare and policing.
Yeah.
You know, do we release a drone? What are the dangers of killing civilians? If we are going to kill civilians, is it worth it in order to achieve a certain objective, or will there be blowback? And all the characters in this movie actually really struggle with this from different points of view. Helen Mirren's character has been tracking a particular individual for 6 years, And when I spoke to military intelligence officers who do that work, they said it's very difficult sometimes to be objective. You want right. that person off your list. But if you're Aaron Paul's character, the pilot, you don't know the history of that. All you know is you're being asked to take the lives of these suicide bombers, and you're highly likely to kill innocent civilians. Yeah. And do you pull that trigger, and what are your orders, and can you question them? If you're the wonderful Alan Rickman, who plays a general who has to liaise between Helen Mirren's character and a bunch of politicians who ultimately have to make this decision because it's a high-value target and there are British citizens and American citizens involved who are being targeted, and everybody wants to pass the buck and refer it up what they call the kill chain, yeah. it's understandable that you might feel very stressed. It's easy to laugh at the politicians, but would you like to be the Minister of Affairs for Africa that actually says, yes, put a hellfire through that roof, and if we lose 20 civilians, that's okay? It's a stress. So refer that to the foreign secretary. This is beyond my pay.
And that's what the movie's about. I mean, it's about responsibility and who where the buck stops. And,
exactly.
and you find in noticing behind the scenes, this is one drone strike.
Yeah.
This is one drone strike. And like I said in the intro, you see so many different stories pop up in the newspaper that says a drone strike killed terrorist suspects in Pakistan or here, there, wherever.
Yeah.
And you don't think at all about all of the hand-wringing and the, I guess, the conflict that went into that decision in the first place.
Yes, and I hasten to say that, you know, depending on the importance of the target, and this is creepy in itself because is one life worth more than another? All of these questions play into it. But depending on the importance of the target, the authority to strike will be referred higher and higher up what they call the kill chain. Mm-hmm. If you're using drones over Iraq or Afghanistan, which are already defined as conflict zones, you may not have as much hand-wringing as you have if you decide to launch a drone over Yemen or Somalia or Kenya, in the case of our film. So, but you will see in this film the full so-called chain of command, or otherwise known as the kill chain, which is how who authorizes this particular strike. Should they? Shouldn't they? Meantime, the clock's ticking. You're on the ground. And what I think Guy does so brilliantly is he also gives the point of view of the innocent bystander. You have a family that happens to live next door to this house that knows nothing about what's going right. on next door to them. And the stress that we feel for them is pretty intense. And ultimately, the film asks a very ancient question ethically, which is, would you trade an innocent life in order to save more lives right. potentially? And that's a tricky one.
And that's always a great thing about any film that you watch, to be able to have these thoughts and these questions that aren't really answered. I mean,
right.
they're not. That's a big part of it.
No, thank you for that. I don't want the audience to think that the film in any way tells them what to think. What
right.
I loved about Guy's script is he presents a very, very tense, complicated situation and allows you to look at it from multiple points of view, which constantly shift your perspective, but ultimately leaves you to decide what you think. And so, in a sense, it's just a great thriller that leaves you with something to talk about.
Gavin Hood is the director of Eye in the Sky. It opens this weekend here in Chicago. Let's take a break. We come back, talk more about shooting this film. It's
yep.
interesting, some of the stuff you had to go through to
technically yeah,
put all that together. Gavin Hood is in studio with me. Stay with us. Welcome back to The Download here on WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. My guest tonight at the big table, Gavin Hood.
Hi, Justin.
Hollywood director, the new movie Eye in the Sky starring Helen Mirren and the late Alan Rickman mm-hmm. Is in theaters in Chicago this weekend. Talk about Alan Rickman. This was, you know, is this his final film?
Sadly, yes. None of us knew that this would be his last film, obviously. All I would like to say is I'm so thankful that he is in this film because he does such a fantastic job of a role that could so easily be just a stereotype. He plays the role of a general who liaises between Helen Mirren, playing a British commander running a drone operation, and the politicians that she has to refer up to get permission to strike. And so he finds himself in a very frustrating position because in the world that he came from, before all this technology of videos where everybody can see mm-hmm. everything all the time, you know, his view is the military should be allowed to make the decision they need to make without interference from all these people watching on screens.
Right.
But now these sort of things play out in real time. Politicians have access to those video feeds. And on the one hand, it leads to better oversight. On the other hand, it can lead to delays and hand-wringing and so on. So what Alan does so well is he brings an amazing kind of humor to the film. And it doesn't come out of any kind of slapstick, comedic It comes out of the farcical situation, the frustrating situation in which he finds himself as a general. And it could so easily have just been a general frustrated. Mm-hmm. But Alan, you know, he has this tremendous intellect. He's funny, but he's so economical with his acting. Just with the slightest roll of an eye or the slightest twist on a line, he puts a dart into a politician.
He does. He's really good.
And makes you laugh. Yeah. So
he really does. It's interesting because, you know, there's a little bit of the subtlety of war from afar in this movie. These soldiers are working 9 to 5, and they're in a boardroom making decisions on people's lives with the click of a button.
From thousands of miles away.
And we've heard that argument before, and it plays out in this movie. But he plays it so well because he is that guy. I mean, even at the beginning of the movie, he's doing something for his life.
Well, you raise a great point. One of the things that was interesting in the research about drone pilots or any of the folks involved in this kind of remote warfare where they wake up at home, go 10 minutes down the road, and then they're on the battlefield, and then they go home, and they go to say, how was your day, honey?
Right.
So we've all heard that story. But what was interesting to me is the research going into this, because 30% of drone pilots, which is double fighter pilots, are suffering post-traumatic stress disorder. Why? And what it seems to be is that it's very, very difficult to compartmentalize, is the word they use, your war life with your home life. Now, if you look at the character of Alan Rickman, what Alan does so well, and frankly what Guy Hibbert's writing does so well, is he presents you with just a little scene of his home life. He's just shopping for a doll for his granddaughter before he goes to work. And he is able to compartmentalize this general who's been doing it for 50 years. This is my home life.
Mm-hmm.
This is work. And there's a wonderful moment that he plays as he comes out, Alan, as he comes out after the operation, before he gets the doll from his assistant that he has to give to his granddaughter. He goes, right, we're back in that world. Whether Aaron Paul's character after this experience will be able to compartmentalize in that way is something I think that's up for question.
How much did you know about all of this before you started this project? I mean, because you can research into drone, and you said, the story's been told before. I mean, did you have a curiosity into drone warfare before?
I knew probably as much as anyone else. I knew there were drones. I knew that strikes happen. I knew that occasionally civilians, or sometimes people argue more than occasionally, civilians are killed. What is the blowback effect? Is this a good policy? But I hadn't done any kind of deep dive into it. And so when I first read the script, I didn't go and see Colin Firth and Jed Doherty, the producers, for a month. I asked my agent, please, I really, really am interested in this film, but can they hold? Because I don't want to go to a meeting without knowing something more about this. And frankly, I wasn't sure if it was accurately researched. So I called some folks I knew who were in the Air Force. I called people in human rights law. I'm a lawyer myself, so I dug in really deep into the research. And after about a month, I can assure the audience that what you see in this film is accurately researched. I went from a meeting after a month of research, and then I spent another 6 months working with Guy and talking to people in the military and people in human rights organizations and people on all sides of this discussion. And I do want to say, in fairness to the military, it's easy to think the military thinks one thing. This conversation is also happening within the military. We've shown the film to the military. We had military advisors on the film. Everyone in the military is also struggling with what kind of legal framework governs this new way of waging
that
war.
That was a big part of the movie, is every decision that had to be made was checked with legal before a decision was made. And I thought that was, like, you don't usually see that in military movies or movies. It's not like, let me check with the lawyer before we make this military decision.
Right. And also, you know, then the politicians, because you might find that you're on the right side of the law. You're not going to commit a war crime here. You've done your diligence. You believe that the use of force is in proportion to the threat. This is the kind of language that is used, you know. Is the force we're using proportional to the threat? If we're using excessive force, then that could be a war crime. So you need to back off. Okay, if we've ironed out the legal position, just when we thought we got that right, a politician steps in and says, wait a minute, I don't mind if this is legal. What's the political blowback here? If we kill one innocent child in a friendly country, what do you think that local population is going to think of us? This is the horrifying moment when this one politician says, maybe it's better to let Al-Shabaab blow their suicide bomb up and take 80 lives. Because they'll be blamed by the local population.
Right.
And we have to win.
As opposed to us killing civilians. Right?
We have to win the so-called propaganda war. And you can sort of say, but actually, it's a real question. Are we winning the ideological war? Or is this ideology spreading? And if it's spreading, are our tactics, is what we're doing effective? And that's a huge question, and believe me, the military are talking about that. But they, you know, generals have different points of view.
Well, you hear a lot of, I would say, politicians and scholars talking about this issue.
Yeah.
Rarely is this issue playing out in entertainment. You know, like, I mean, think about it. Movies usually, if you're going to, even drones, there's it's almost got a high-tech feel. Like, it's almost used in superhero. I think of, like, Avengers and things like that.
Yeah, we always have to hype it.
Yeah, we hype it. But this is really, do you feel that audiences are going to respond well to the idea of this quandary being presented this way?
That's a really good question. I hope so. We've had very positive feedback from our screening, so I'm cautiously optimistic. But I think what I would like to say to audiences is, if you go to this movie, I know you'll be on the edge of your seat. I know many people will say, oh, these teeny tiny micro drones that fly and land, and you know, these creepy little drone things. Yes, it's all happening. The technology is evolving as fast. We were so worried when we made the film that we'd be behind the technology. There's a tiny drone in our movie that people say, oh, is that real? Not only is it real, it's almost out of date. Those tiny, teeny drones now are completely aware of where they are in relation to other tiny drones, so they can fly in swarms. They fly in with stereoscopic vision, so they build a 3D map of a room. They know the geography of the room. You don't actually have to land these teeny, tiny drones by hand. You can point to the beam or whatever it is you want them to land on that they've now mapped and say, land there. Mm-hmm. And in our movie, they're not yet armed, which is the next step that's happening. Right. In 6 months from now, you'll fly a teeny, tiny drone with a tiny explosive charge in it, and it'll have face recognition software. It'll go find the person it wants, and boom. Or it'll blow a little anthrax up your nose. I mean, it gets very creepy very fast. And so what kind of legal framework, what kind of policy framework are we going to have in place over the coming months or years to manage in some way this incredibly rapidly developing technology in terms of warfare?
Academy Award-winning director Gavin Hood, his new movie, Eye in the Sky, hits theaters this weekend. Thanks for bumming us out.
Thanks for it's a great funny comedy.
Let's take it.
Alan Rickman at least makes you laugh.
Okay, let's take a break. We'll hit the news when we come back. I'd love to talk to you about making this film. Right. It's interesting because you could tell, you know, this is all taking place in screens. You know, it just seems like, you know, everyone is doing this sort of comm hookup all across the world, and I'm sure that was an interesting way to actually direct and get.
It was like a jigsaw puzzle. Yeah. It really was. Yeah.
So we'll talk more with Gavin Hood here on The Download. Stay with us. Welcome back to The Download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. My guest tonight, Academy Award-winning director Gavin Hood. He's got a new movie, Eye in the Sky, which hits theaters this weekend. It stars Helen Mirren, Aaron Paul, the late Alan Rickman. A lot of great actors. And one of the things, you know, I teased out right before the news was just that this movie is almost compartmentalized. I mean, if you think about just the way that people are compartmentalizing, each scene, or where Helen Mirren's at, she's in a control room. Mm-hmm. Where Alan Rickman, and he's in a boardroom with politicians. Mm-hmm. Where Aaron Paul is, and he's in a box
in
Las
Vegas.
Desert,
yeah,
with one other control pilot.
Yeah.
Talk about how you shot this movie, because it seems to me like that would be very difficult, because I'm guessing that there wasn't a lot of interaction between, say, Alan Rickman and Helen Mirren that in person.
No, and thank you for asking. I mean, to complicate matters, we also didn't have any of the actors together for the full duration of the shoot. Just by virtue of their schedules and budget issues, we had to start shooting with Helen Mirren's character, and Helen is in a bunker based on a place called Permanent Joint Headquarters outside of London, in Northwood London, a real place, underground. And she runs an operation from underground with a whole lot of screens, mm-hmm. big video screens that connect her to the drone pilot Aaron Paul plays in Nevada, connect her to Kenyan special forces on the ground in Kenya, all sorts of people all over the world. But unfortunately, we hadn't shot any of the footage that she sees on those screens before she started shooting.
So when she's doing it, it's blank?
Green screens, as the audience would say, and a little red cross says this is where the target house is, and this blue cross is where the little girl is hula hooping, and this cross here is where Alan Rickman will pop up on your screen when you video conference him. And I thought she might turn around and go home, you know. And I said, and by the way, none of them are here, Helen. And I'm afraid I'm going to have to read you through the action.
Okay.
And then if you're on the phone to Aaron, it'll be me replying. I hope that's okay. And so she paused for a moment. And then she said, Gavin, I'm paid to use my imagination. It'll be fine. You tell me what you need. Tell me. And just as long as you describe what it is that's happening. I will do my best to react, and we'll see where we go. And that's how we shot the whole movie, which was quite nerve-wracking for everybody, because Helen then left, and then Aaron Paul, as you say, was in his ground control station, which is a little box, with Phoebe Fox, his sensor operator, so at least the two of them could interact.
Right, right.
But when Helen calls, it's me calling him from offset, going, you know, trying to pretend I'm Helen Mirren, and all credit to Aaron for pretending back so well. And then the same with Alan Rickman. Obviously, in COBRA, which just stands for Cabinet Office Briefing Room A, which is a real place in Whitehall in London where politicians watch these kinds of operations, he did have other politicians with him in the room, wonderful Jeremy Northam and Monica Dolan and Richard McCabe are in the room. But when Helen pops up on the screen, it's yours truly pretending to be Helen again, and they're pretending that I am. And,
was that hard for you as a director? Was that extra pressure put on you to be able to see this project to fruition?
Well, it was and it wasn't. Well, first it was because you'd much rather be able to put all the real footage up on the screen.
But or at least also, have actors interact with each other.
Yeah,
right?
But it also wasn't because, in truth, even if we'd shot the footage that was up on that screen of the drone strike, we would have had to edit it exactly which moment do you want when. And, you know, you could really stretch this process out. And we simply didn't have the time or money to do that. We'd had to do it in 6 weeks. So I'd prepped everybody. Look, I am going to describe the action to you. I'll try and do it in as, you know, honest a way as I can without overly emoting. But if a little girl is lying on the ground on your screen and she can't get up, and when did she? I mean, by the end of the movie, I thought if I have to describe the missile attack one more time, I'm going to shoot myself. But you just do it, and you try and find the pace in your mind that you will have in the final film. So was it stressful? Yes, but it also was strangely paralleled what was going on in the film. None of these folks were together.
Yeah, that's
and in
true.
The film, they're not together.
You shoot this
people
movie.
People are thousands of miles apart.
I mean, and you see a lot of the movie through the screens that are in front of whichever actor is in the room looking at screens. I mean, so Helen Mirren's going to pop up, or they're looking at the house in Nairobi through a screen. But there's a real play with satellite hookup in this movie. I mean, it feels like even a relationship. It's interesting that we see a lot of this film through CompStat.
Yeah, it was tricky. And of course, you know, as I'm saying this, I'm thinking your listeners are going, oh my God, is this going to be dull? I hasten to tell you that the Barkhad Barkhad Abdi from Captain Phillips is in this movie, and he's a special agent on the ground. So we do also shoot the story from his perspective, where he's really there and his life's at risk on the ground. But yes, this intercutting between people actually, ironically, I think lends pace to the movie, because I do think the film is very tense in terms of pace. And because you're cutting to different points of view, it actually, far from being slowing us down, helps add the tension, because who's seeing what when? Did you see? I'm watching now and I need to talk to you. And it was a fascinating jigsaw puzzle to play with. And thanks to my wonderful editor, Megan Gill, we managed to cut it all together.
Well, this movie, I mean, it comes out this weekend, and this will be your seventh feature. Talk about what kind of movie you gravitate towards, because you've done everything.
Because my resume is so confusing.
Well, no, but I mean, it's interesting because there is this play. I mean, obviously you did X-Men Origins Wolverine, which is, you know, the same kind of concept of like thriller, good versus evil. I mean, Wolverine is a hero, but he's not really a hero.
Well, yeah, when you say good versus evil, I love to pick up on that, because I think the ordinary idea of good versus evil is actually a little dangerous, because if we're good and the other guy's evil and all we have to do is defeat the other guy and that makes us triumph, it's a very sort of simple idea. I think what I'm drawn to more, and as you say, even Wolverine has this, he sort of says, I'm the best there is at what I do, but what I do isn't very nice. It's a guy wrestling with his own inner demons and trying to find his own moral compass. And if that's a theme that runs through my work, I think that's true. Having said that, my origins as a filmmaker were smaller films where, frankly, I was lulled into a sense that I would have more control. And when I came to do that rather big film, I was not, I don't think, prepared for the
movement, the Hollywood
studio committee, and the writer's strike hit, and there was all this rewriting and other characters coming in. And I felt in that movie, I hate to say it, as if I was trying to survive, and I swore after that film that I would not make a film without a script that was properly locked, properly decided upon, so that we all were completely clear of what it was we were making. So when a script like Guy's comes along on this film, and I get to work with Guy, you know, who's already written a great piece, and I get to work with him for 3 or 4 months, and we don't have to change a word, and we can focus on exploring the themes that have already been well articulated in the script, and we get a great cast of actors, and the producers behind this film really want to make this film, and we all know what we're making with Colin Firth and Jed Doherty and great team, it's just a much more pleasant experience, and I think the result is better.
Now, you know, it's great that you can choose that, and you're at a career, you're at your point in your career where you can do that. In Hollywood, for directors that are coming up, how often does that happen where a script's not done or producers are involved?
I think they're backing into release dates. It was certainly the case with us. You know, you're backing into release date. You're part of a machine. I was, you know, not experienced enough to know how that machine worked. And I think now I would still like to do big films. It doesn't matter whether it's big or small. It's do you feel you can bring something to this project and that when you're done, you'll feel good about that project. And I feel so happy to have made a film with a group of people who were committed to the film. If you don't like this movie, blame me fair and square. Say I screwed up. But I felt like I was more on my turf again. And it was wonderful to make a film with people committed to making the same film.
Can you see yourself, I mean, you talked about being a lawyer. Mm. Can you see yourself in a life without film at this point? I mean, you've done so much, and we talked about some of the small stuff, even winning the Oscar in 2005, to the features, big Hollywood features without a script, and the big studio thing, to working with, you know, pretending you're someone else to do a scene with Helen Mirren. Is there a life for Gavin Hood without film?
I guess it's too late. I mean, I don't think anybody would employ me as anything else. So, no, what I love about, I feel so lucky about this job, and as I get older and feeling safer to select the projects that I want to do and not do things just because agents think it'll be good for your career or whatever, you know, you wise up. And I think that where I'm so lucky is you don't know what's going to happen. I mean, to have a script arrive, one morning I'm sitting saying goodbye to my kids, a script, I open the script, and all of a sudden I'm exposed to a world I don't know enough about, and a writer is taking me into a whole new world. And for 3 years I've been immersed in this world, and now what will I do? I don't know, but there are things coming in, and all of a sudden you're so lucky to be able to go down a road and explore something else. I feel very lucky to have this job.
Gavin Hood's movie Eye in the Sky hits the theaters here in Chicago this weekend.
Yep.
The Academy Award-winning director is in town promoting it. Gavin Hood, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you very much indeed for having me. Thank you.
And when it comes to baseball, we have two favorite clubs, the Go-Go White Sox and whoever plays a Cub.
Oh, there you go. It's the download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, the Chicago Cubs are beating up on their opponent. I believe they're playing the Diamondbacks today, but they're beating up with them. Just a blowout in spring training, like it matters. But even the Cubs, which are the juggernaut in Chicago, everybody hits all eyes on them. If you would have said 2 weeks ago the Chicago White, who? Like, you wouldn't even know. But then trouble bubbles up. Adam LaRoche retires. They ask him why. He says because the White Sox management won't let him bring his 14-year-old son to the clubhouse. Kenny Williams confirms it. And all heck breaks loose in the last 2 days. Kevin Powell is covering baseball in Arizona right now for WGN Radio. He joins us now. Hey, Kevin, how are you, buddy?
I'm doing well, enjoying the beautiful desert air right now. It's, I believe, still in the 80s. Not sure when it's back in Chicago. But and real quickly, Justin, I know you mentioned the Cubs blowing out the Diamondbacks. 15,329 is the attendance at sold-out Sloan Park.
Wow.
People are scalping tickets down the street as I'm pulling up for a spring training game.
So maybe the news cycle is paying more attention to the White Sox, but the fans are still keened in on the Cubs.
A large Chicago contingent out here, Justin, yeah. as you're aware. So they came to watch the Cubs, but yes, the White Sox stealing the headlines, that's for sure.
So let me ask you.
Getting messy over there.
Yeah, what's I mean, even today, I mean, CBS and Sports and also Sun-Times has that Chris Sale got into a contentious argument with Kenny Williams over this. Players from all over Major League Baseball are tweeting out, good for you, Adam. We believe baseball is family. I mean, this is not going well for Chicago White Sox management.
Not going well for management, but I will say this, that overall, White Sox fans, I'm pretty happy with Kenny Williams.
Yeah.
I mean, White Sox fans were frustrated with Adam LaRoche last year. This has now cleared $13 million off the books. We've gotten a couple reports that haven't been confirmed today that have kind of been on social media that players on the White Sox roster went to Kenny Williams and complained about Drake LaRoche, Adam Stone, being around too often. Hmm. Now, if that's the case, you know, there's a few things to hit here. One, why are they going to Kenny Williams? Where, what sort of power structure does the White Sox front office have? Why Kenny Williams, not Rick Hahn, not even Robin Ventura, the manager? So that's one thing to look at.
Yeah.
Now, if the Chris Sale outburst is true, and if the players complaining to Williams is true, and you also have another issue on your hands, that means you have a divided locker room, a divided clubhouse. You have some players who stood up and were supporting LaRoche. You have some players who are complaining about it. So
after
what does that
weeks,
say about
after,
your clubhouse?
After 2 weeks, I mean, we just started. I mean, this is a long season. To have at least a perceived divided clubhouse, not a good start for the Chicago White Sox. I got to ask, I mean, the league look poorly upon the Chicago White Sox and their troubles in their clubhouse, and does it affect, say, the manager, Robin Ventura?
Well, I don't know how much it affects Robin Ventura, because the players had threatened to boycott yesterday's spring training game. Robin Ventura was the one that was able to step in and settle things down and convince the players that they needed to be at the game. But there were some reports today also that Adam LaRoche has been bringing his son Drake to the clubhouses, to the stadium, for a while now, going back to his days with the Nationals in Washington. And according to one report from our friend David Kaplan, he says that this was sort of a handshake agreement and played a big part in LaRoche deciding to come to Chicago, was that if he does sign a contract with the Sox, that he would be able to bring his son to the park every day. I mean, the White Sox gave Drake LaRoche a locker at U.S. Cellular Field. They gave him a locker here at Sloan Park as well.
Yeah.
At Camelback Ranch. So, you know, that's, I think, where the White Sox front office looks at, that sort of thing. But I think Kenny Williams right now, I think he's taking a bullet a little bit here.
Yeah, you know, maybe he's the one guy who can do it. Yeah, maybe he's the one guy who can step up and say, I don't really need to be the friend of everybody in the clubhouse. I'll say it, guys. That's how it feels with Kenny Williams getting involved.
I think that may be the case, Justin.
Let's move on from the White Sox, because it's the White Sox, there's plenty to talk about on the field, but on the other side of town, I mean, even in Arizona, but the Cubs drawing huge crowds, very relaxed clubhouse and mm-hmm. spring training. Do you feel that? I mean, do you feel anything special covering the Cubs out there?
I do. It seems like they're kind of on cruise control right now, and everyone has sort of a focus to them, but it's very loose, and I think it all starts at the top with Joe Maddon, who every time you talk to him just has this cool vibe to him. Always a great quote. I mean, the first day I was there, I walked up to one of the practice fields, and they're blasting music from a speaker behind home plate. So they're not exactly uptight out here in Mesa. So they seem to be having a great time. I mean, you know, you look up and down their roster and you try to find holes, and you really can't. I mean, if you want to nitpick defensively in left field, that can be an issue with Schwarber possibly, Soler getting some time out there, and then maybe the back end of the rotation, but they have depth in the bullpen. So, you know, I mean, that's just me being nitpicky. the team really, they look great. I mean, up and down, and I think it, you know, and even if the back end of the pitching rotation doesn't hold up, There's always a trade deadline, and the Cubs have
a lot of
pieces to move around if they want to.
Let me ask you this, Kevin. I mean, the vibe of covering spring training. I mean, is it formal? Is it casual? What's it like for being out there and covering this Chicago Cubs team?
I would say it's more casual. I mean, I think they're having a good time. And they're trying to enjoy it. I mean, look, it's a month out here of practicing and drills and things like that. But, you know, there's an underlying tone of that focus. And you can tell when they need to be at that level. But, no, there's definitely a loose. I mean, it seems like every other day there's a viral video out of this camp between Kawasaki karaoke or Joe Maddon driving his 70s van out onto the field. But, you know, just being in the clubhouse today with guys kind of just laughing, goofing around after they finished the warm-ups, watching some college basketball. And, that's sort of the vibe I've picked up out here.
Wow. Well, when do you come back?
I'll be back late Saturday night. So a full day tomorrow, Cubs Sox play. So I'll be out in Glendale. Sox had the day off, so we spent the day in Mesa. We'll see if we can get any more LaRoche news tomorrow. Then we'll watch the Cubs and Sox play. And I'll be on the beat Saturday. And then we'll kind of wrap it up, and I'll head back to Chicago.
All right. Kevin Powell for WGN Radio Sports. Kevin, thanks for checking in from Arizona.
Thanks, Justin. Talk to you soon.
All right, welcome back to The Download here on WGN Radio. This weekend, the wildly popular Comic-Con C2E2 comes back to McCormick Place. It's a great convention that showcases comic books, geek culture, celebrities, and cosplay, which is dressing up like your favorite superhero or villain or comic book character. What's really interesting is that many of the comic book fans and convention goers, they go on tour. They follow Comic-Cons. They travel with the shows. And they're the stars. The ones that dress up like Harley Quinn or Poison Ivy or the Joker, or I don't want to leave Marvel out. I guess there's a couple Iron Mans here and there. But they are the ones that, I mean, they're stars. They get their pictures taken everywhere they go. It's part of the show. Welcoming them to Chicago this weekend, of course, the Metro. They're having an unofficial C2E2 after party, which will feature burlesque and other performances. Adam Guarino is a Chicago performer. He's been known to dress up for a Comic-Con or two.
That's true.
And he's helping organize the party tomorrow night at Metro. Adam, good to see you.
Thank you for having me.
All right, let's talk about this because your group is called All Geeks. I mean, that's mm-hmm. the group you've had. Tell us about All Geeks.
So All Geeks started about a year and a half ago. I've done variety shows in Chicago. And I've done different themes. I've done comedy shows. And we decided to do a geek one. And I'm a huge geek. I was raised with geek culture from Star Trek to Star Wars to G.I. Joe, X-Men, comic books. And to do a geeky cosplay one, we had drag, we had burlesque, and it was gangbusters.
Everybody loved it.
Everybody loved it. And they're like, can you do this always? And I was like, I didn't know that was an option. Yes, please. So we've been doing it for a long time.
Thank you for asking.
Yes, absolutely. This is my jam, and I didn't know it was a possibility. So we've nationally toured it. We come off of two cons now, New York Comic Con most recently in October, and then before that, C2E2 here last year. And we sold out both of them, and we're very excited.
So the idea
to come
is
back.
you do shows that sort of bring everybody who's part of the C2E2 or the Comic Con, anyone who's interested in that, and they said there's going to be, it's almost like a Lollapalooza after party.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Same concept, right?
Yeah, like if you like this, you'll like this. Yeah. So if there's a con in town, we definitely think that a lot of those people might be more prone to going out for a geeky thing. Mm-hmm. And kind of the premise with All Geeks is that all geeks are welcome. You know, if you're cosplaying, a lot of times you're representing a certain character. And we say we don't care about the age, body type, ethnic background, sexual orientation of who you're cosplaying. Make it your own. And so we kind of combat that with inclusion, which is all geeks.
Because you run, I mean, I'd say this lightly. I mean, a lot of times the cosplay that's going to be the most popular at a C2E2 is the sexy cosplay.
Sure.
Right? It's going to be the people who dress up like a Harley Quinn or something, and it's cleavage and everything down the line. But you see a lot of that, and that's almost what people, there's this weird kind of body image stuff to this as well.
When you think of any kind of inclusion, the first to be included is the hot ones. And I think the cosplay is no stranger to that. It's like, oh, sure, you're dressing up like a geek character. All right. Well, as long as you're attractive.
Yeah, right,
and
right.
And that's great for, you know, getting your foot in the door. But what we're trying to do is make sure everybody feels welcome. And geek culture, when we're talking about geek culture, we're talking about our childhoods. We're talking about when you're playing video games by yourself, you know, the lights are off and there's the light from the TV and you're playing video games by yourself. It's very interior is what I mean, which can mean sometimes that people be or there are protective of it. And what's nice about that is that this is something where everybody's welcome. You don't need encyclopedic knowledge of geek culture.
Well, that's, I mean, the entry part of it. You know, a lot of people who might be fans of Superman or Batman or comic books or maybe even mainstream stuff that now is the Avengers on mainstream, you know, everywhere. They feel like, well, they don't necessarily want to go into the realm that is the Comic-Con because that's where the geeks get very provincial.
Right. And I was the same way. I actually hadn't been to a con until last year. And now I've been to several and I've hosted after parties. I've always been a geek, but I didn't know if going to a con was necessarily an extension of that geekiness. If I'm a geek, will I enjoy myself, or is that a different kind of geek, or whatever? It can be intimidating.
Is it cliquish, like that kind of stuff?
Sure.
Right, right,
are they all into each other? Are they about not going to get picked to be on their volleyball team? I don't know. but it's great. It's welcoming. And I find that you are accepted in these communities, whether you are wearing a Winter is Coming Game of Thrones t-shirt or whether you are not wearing anything geeky at all. The fact that you're there is you're supportive of that culture. And it's a lot more welcoming because when you see the pictures, you do see the cosplay. Mm-hmm. You do see people with possibly hundreds of dollars in costuming involved with it. And it can seem unapproachable.
It really does. I mean, it's amazing. I've been to a couple now. I've been to C2E2 the last couple of years. And every time I go, I'm like, it's the amount of production that is put into this by people who are just, I'm going to be Bane. And then you're like, you're Bane, and you put some effort into this. This is not Halloween.
Do I call you Bane from now on? That's how good your costume is.
You are Bane, right. So, I mean, there is that kind of thing where people are investing money into dressing up for a Comic-Con.
Absolutely. And although those are, I hesitate to say mascots, they are the images that we conjure when we think of these cons. They are not the only people welcome. Have you been and not dressed up?
Yes, I've never.
And you felt fine.
I felt fine.
Yeah.
But my son is into it. So, and he dresses up, which is really fun. And he's young. He's like 7, 8 years old.
Yep.
So the idea of doing it is almost like it's been really fun because he's not really athletic.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's not really into the sports stuff, but you could see like his eyes just light up to be a part of this community, which is great.
Sure.
He's a good example of somebody who's really likes it.
We try to cover our bases with the after party tomorrow, Friday at 11 at the Metro. We have over $2,000 in prizes from everywhere from Dice Dojo to Grimcracker Comics to Chicago Comics to Arda Wigs. A lot of different places are donating for the costume contest. But at the same time, you can go and see world-class talent doing drag, live singing, burlesque as cosplay characters. And it's not just comic books. It's everything from Star Wars to Harry Potter. Mm-hmm. And we've got a lot of surprises as well. But it's a great show. Live DJs, photo walls, costume contest. But you don't have to
dress
up.
It's at Metro tomorrow. It's 11 o'clock. It's the unofficial after party for C2E2 put on by All Geeks. Adam Guarino is the founder of All Geeks, and he's also a Chicago-based performer. Let's take a break. Come back. I'd love to talk to you about just the way that geek culture is really taking over mainstream. Mm-hmm. I mean, you talk about like playing videos in the dark. I mean, that's our generation. Right. This generation is it.
It's
the cool kids. So we'll talk about that coming up here on the Download 720 WGN. Stay with us. Yeah, it's a Download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. With me tonight, Adam Guarino. He's the man behind All Geeks. They're doing an unofficial C2E2 after party tomorrow night at Metro at 11 o'clock. We were talking about C2E2 coming to town. I mean, obviously, this is a celebration of geek culture, but it's also a celebration of superheroes, which I'm not sure anymore can be categorized as geek culture because we've seen Hollywood take over. I mean, we talked about this on the show not too long ago that they have, Star Wars and Avengers and Batman and Superman scheduled till 2020.
Yeah, it's like, let's go see a superhero movie. It's its own classification now. It doesn't even seem like geek culture. I don't have the numbers in front of me, but like half of the top 10 grossing movies of all time are like superheroes or at least geeky, if you include Harry Potter and things as well. Mm-hmm. And it used to be subculture. I think people might have thought at the time, Star Wars or things like that in the 70s or 80s, oh, it was a fluke that was so popular. But now it's so common that it's the safe thing to do.
Is there a rebellion in sort of the community to say that there needs to be a split, that superhero movies, may not fall into that category anymore, so that's its own thing and geek culture is this instead?
I don't know if geek culture necessarily has removed superhero movies from geek culture. There's definitely a resistance to comic books emulating superhero movies, emulating comic books and TV shows and vice versa, where they're all parodying each other. Mm-hmm. And I think that their geek culture can get annoyed with that sometimes because you see a portrayal in a movie that's not what their portrayal was in the comic books. And then it becomes, you know, vice versa. They both are different because of one becoming more popular.
Right. You know, it was interesting. We just had the conversation about Deadpool. Deadpool being one of the biggest, you know, grossing movies, rated R movies of all time.
The greatest, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And it was an interest. To me, it was a decision made by, I guess it was Fox who made that movie, to make that a rated R movie, to make that more for adults than for kids, because you've seen a lot of superheroes, even the Avenger movies,
Yeah. They're
really geared towards kids, maybe 10 years old, 12 years old. I mean, that sort of popcorn summer blockbuster.
Right.
Deadpool was for almost geeks.
Well, the superheroes are smart enough like Pixar, where they are good for the adults and the kids. And it can be the wide range, in my opinion. But Deadpool, yeah. Although, to be fair, when I saw Deadpool, there was a lot of 7-year-olds there. I don't know if you had this experience at all.
I kept my kid away from it.
No, there were like kids there, and I was like, oh, my God.
Do you think they just didn't – the parents were like, oh, it's a superhero. I can take my kid to this. It's safe. And then they didn't realize that it was rated R?
They're like, this will be just like Captain America. Right. Oh, God, shield your eyes. I don't know. I think Deadpool, they made a conscious decision to make it rated R, knowing the character. And a lot of the success of Deadpool was knowing the character as opposed to knowing what has been a successful superhero movie before. And I hope people take that away as opposed to what I'm hearing, which is Batman and Superman will have a rated R movie now, possibly just emulate Deadpool.
Is that what it is? Is that going to be rated R?
It was called rated R like almost immediately after it was announced how Deadpool was super successful. And I don't like the idea of DC copying Marvel, because I think Marvel movies are better, but only because Marvel movies are themselves.
Do you? I mean, that's a big thing in geek culture.
Marvel versus DC.
Yep. I mean, those are the top companies. They're the ones making all the comic books. I mean, do you see a division down the line? I mean, who's winning right now?
I'd say any true geek changes all the time depending upon who's making it. Because 10 years ago, the best cartoons were DC. And that was the best we were getting. We weren't getting movies. We were seeing the most amazing Justice League cartoons that before that were the Superman, Batman cartoons. And they were some of the best quality things you saw that were out there. And now we see Marvel movies and Marvel TV being a lot smarter, more successful, more artistic. And DC kind of wanting to be those things.
Well, I read a great piece about, you know, how you can go wrong with the two biggest franchises in superheroes. I mean, you could say what you want about the Avengers, but Batman and Superman are they're the biggest storylines. To put them together, it's a no-brainer. Yeah. Gazillion dollars coming in, but they said not so fast, because that Batman versus Superman has always been commercially successful.
Yeah. I don't know if it will be. I think that the question is, do DC movies know their characters? And Green Lantern, they didn't. And Batman, they did with the Nolan movies.
Yeah, right.
And I don't think Superman, the last one, did.
Yeah.
And we'll see, because the people who are making the DC movie universe made Superman.
Well,
so we'll
I
see.
Mean, that movie was saved by Michael Shannon. Our Chicago guys saved General Zod.
Yes,
all right,
yes.
So let's go back and talk about C2E2 and the cosplay stuff, because you see, like I said, I mean, you see the sort of sexy cosplay, but in your mind, what makes a great character or costume or cosplay at a con?
For me, I'd say that what really gets me is if it doesn't seem obvious and you seem like you share this kinship with the costume. What I like to think of as really great cosplay is if you have a name tag that says, ask me about this. And I feel that way about it when I see a cosplay that may be a cartoon that you've never seen somebody cosplay from there before. And you're like, oh my gosh, I love this. Let's talk about this. And I think that's what it is you're wearing this name tag saying, I'm interested in this. Mm-hmm. And you're calling people out to approach you to talk about it. And of course, you know, some popular things will be more common because they're more popular. But my favorite cosplay is usually just finding out by looking at somebody what their interests are and what you can talk about.
And that's the whole point, right?
I think so.
Right? I mean, that's it. I mean, you automatically know they're into this comic. They're into dressing up this way. It's a personality share.
Yeah. And I never try to shame anybody for how much they know about anything with geek culture. But sometimes you'll be like, oh, my gosh, I love this. This artist that's a favorite comic book artist of mine designed this costume. And they're like, who? You know, and it's like, that's fine if you don't. You like the character, maybe, and maybe you don't have the same thing. Or the same kind of approach. Like maybe they like Harley Quinn, but they don't know that you're wearing the cartoon series Harley Quinn as opposed to the video game Harley Quinn, which are, you know, a great example, two classic different costumes. One's roller derby and one's jester clown. But, you know, that's a conversation of its own, and it doesn't have to be like I know more or I know less. It could just be tell me about what kind of Harley Quinns you like.
All right, let me ask you this, Adam Guarino. If you're going to cosplay at C2E2, you go superhero or villain?
I usually go hero. That's funny. I've never really thought about it before, but I think I've always been on the hero side, maybe because I want to be approachable. Because I have to be the host of a lot of shows, I don't want people to be scared that I'm going to destroy the world if they don't applaud for
They're afraid you're going to unleash some sort of chemical that ruins the...
Give me the applause or else I will destroy Earth.
Well, I mean, I would assume in the last year and a half by doing the after parties and having this relationship with that cosplay community and the con community, what have you learned about it? I mean, because you've done shows in Chicago, you've done a lot of stuff here, but being the guy now that is almost the unofficial after party guy for Comic-Cons, talk about your relationship and what you've learned from that community.
Everything anybody knows about geek culture is wrong. When I started doing the shows, I was told by so many different people, you're trying to cater a social event toward introverts. You're trying to find a focus in niche culture. And it was gangbusters. So many people wanted to go. And what we prove with every single show, no matter where it is, and we're going to prove it again tomorrow, is geeks aren't geeks, which determine that they don't like to go out and dance, that they don't like to be in crowds, that they don't like whatever.
It's a common misconception. You like comic books, you must be a geek. If you're a geek, then you don't know how to talk to people.
Yeah, right? And I hope that introverts feel welcome at these shows as well. But I think what we're learning is that geeks are everybody. And it has something with an interest, not a personality type. And that's my biggest takeaway, is what we thought of geeks was wrong.
Adam Guarino is the man behind All Geeks, which is putting on the unofficial C2E2 after party, which is tomorrow night at Metro Chicago, up on Clark Street, 11 o'clock.
So it's 11 after o'clock.
Because the con shuts down at 10, so people get out of there. They all try to hail their cabs in their Harley Quinn costumes.
Or go get changed into a different costume. They have time. Oh. Yeah.
Yeah, that's what you're recommending, the change
they
costumes.
They can if they want, yeah.
I like that. That's a good idea. You got to be fresh. You got to look fresh. You can't be showing up after all day.
Is that the Harley Quinn that you wore earlier? For shame. No. I hope to see everybody there. It's going to be huge costume prizes, but even if you're not dressing up, it's going to be a lot of fun.
Adam Guarino, thanks for being here, man.
Thank you.
Happy St. Patrick's Day, Chicago. It's a download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. Pete Zimmerman really getting the tracks. He went deep on these. He went to the old wreck. He went vinyl.
Mm-hmm. That's me on the tin whistle, by the way.
Are you a big St. Patrick's guy?
Not really. No. I'm a professional drinker, Justin.
You said this is amateur hour week. Yeah. This is amateur week. Yeah, I didn't do anything this weekend. Like, it's funny. I feel terrible. Although it was amusing that I went on Saturday night there while everyone outside at the movie theater I was at was Irish, you know, green shirts, and they were drunk coming out of the Lincoln Park Theater, and I went inside to watch Spotlight. That was the movie I saw, but it was packed. I was surprised. I was like, we were kind of late, and I'm like, who's going to see Spotlight on St. Patrick's Day weekend? And also, like, a movie that's 6 months out.
Yeah,
right?
I think it's, like, available to rent now.
I was the one guy like, excuse me. Like, we're late. Sorry, excuse me. Pretzel Bites. Got to get the Pretzel Bites. It's not, but it's a great movie. But the
terrific.
Yeah, and today, I mean, the one thing I did for all the for Download Nation, you know, I've been talking about my crock potting.
Yeah, you've been working.
I've been working it, and this week I did corned beef and cabbage.
Nice,
and it turned out really great. And so today, that was my treat, my St. Patrick's Day treat to myself. I made corned beef and cabbage.
So you put corned beef and cabbage in the crock pot,
Pete? I mean, listeners, who's this guy? Who's Pete? Does he even know, guys? Right? We're cooks, right? No, it was a recipe that I pulled from Martha Stewart because we're tight. Mm-hmm. I've had a conversation with Martha Stewart in my life.
She gave you the index card that it was on?
When we had the conversation, it was at the James Beard Awards, and she had won an award, and then I had won an award. And afterwards, you go backstage, and you stand in line so the people could take your picture. And I was behind her, and I was like, hey, Martha Stewart, both winners. And she didn't say a word.
Nothing?
So it wasn't really... She just had a smile, you know, it was like a half smile, like, you can't talk to me. Like, that was the vibe. So it was cool. I was like, all right, well, I think she was kind of amused at the dweebish 21-year-old, because it was a long time ago, that was like, oh, hey, Martha Stewart, we're both winners. And she's like, wow, the balls on this guy. So anyway, I took one of her recipes.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, it was good. It was a corned beef with a lot of thyme, T-H-Y-M-E, mm-hmm. a lot of thyme. And then what you do is you put that in with the potatoes and the carrots and the celery and, you know, a broth of sorts. And then you cook the meat for like 8 hours low, and then you add the cabbage on the last hour.
Oh, man.
Yeah. And it's really tasty. Turned out. And now I have to eat it for the next 3 days. That's the only thing. I had it for lunch and dinner, and I'm going to have it for lunch and dinner tomorrow, and then probably Saturday for lunch.
That's good eating, though.
There you go. Well, coming up, we're going to talk Louder Than a Bomb here on WGN. All right. Welcome back to The Download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, all this month, Chicago's been hosting Louder Than a Bomb. It's a citywide poetry festival put on by young Chicago authors. It's one of the most positive events created for Chicago youth, I would say, in generations. I mean, it sports a who's who of alumni, Chance the Rapper and Donnie Trumpet, which we just heard in the song coming in here, Mick Jenkins, others, several rising stars on the hip-hop scene here in Chicago. And we're getting closer to the end of the, I guess we call it a tournament. That's the kind of the word here. A final, which will be on stage at the Auditorium Theater on this Saturday. Tonight was the finals for individual poetry, which the tournament at the Auditorium will be groups. But this is for individuals, and we have the top three finalists in studio with us tonight. How's everybody doing?
Awesome.
Good. You were just on stage at the DuSable Museum, and you're here now?
Yeah.
How about that? Thank you for coming down. I appreciate it. Let me get to your names here. Irion Roach, she's 17 years old. Congratulations on being a finalist.
Thank you so much. Sejari
Villegas, did I get it right?
Yep.
Sejari's 17 years old. And Charlotte Namakule, did I close?
Namakula.
Enough. All right, well, they're close enough. How old are you?
I'm 15.
15. Welcome to The Download. We appreciate it. And joining us also is poet, vocalist, and songwriter Jamila Woods. She's the Associate Artistic Director at Young Chicago Authors. She helps organize Louder Than a Bomb. That's her day job. She's really known. She's an extremely talented Chicago musician who did the hook on Chance the Rapper's Sunday Candy. Welcome to the show. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
So let me start with you. I mean, this was a big event tonight. How did it go?
It was amazing. We were just talking about it on the ride over here. It was just stacked. Like, there it was a whole
good poem after good poem, looking at the judges' faces. They were having a hard time. It looked like they were going to faint at one point. It was kind of overload. But yeah, they had represented poets from all over the city, South Side, West Side, suburbs, North Side.
And this was the, and I mentioned in the intro, this was the individual, because there's also the teams, which are going to be at the auditorium. That's the teams, and those, there's a, hundreds of teams.
Yeah,
right?
So these, out of like 1,200 poets,
wow,
we have the top three sitting with us today, individuals. Tomorrow night, we're going to have the top four teams out of about 130 teams all, from all over the city and Chicagoland.
Does it amaze you, I mean, to the amount of people who are interested in being a part of this, right?
Mm,
I mean, that's what I find. It's not just about the what you guys put on the show, but, I mean, the kids just really want to get involved in this.
Yeah, it's a lot goes into planning the festival. It goes 5 weeks, February through March, but we're really working all year round. A lot of the poets, you know, they've started since fall working on their poems, getting their teams together. And it's not just about, we don't even call it a tournament or a competition. Yeah. We call it a festival, because it's really about building community and bringing together people who wouldn't have met each other otherwise.
Right. How about it, huh? Okay, well, let's go around the table. So, Irion, let me ask you, got in front of a huge crowd tonight. You performed. Obviously, you were part of the festival leading up to this. Mm-hmm. Talk about what you performed and the feeling of being up on that stage and winning.
Sure. Well, I performed two pieces. There were two rounds. It starts out with 13 poets in the first round, and the second round is the top seven. So the first piece I did was called Black Senses, and it was about... my name is pretty hard to pronounce. I've experienced that, but
it's Irion.
That's it. Yeah,
so, yeah.
It's phonetic, but you know, it's one of those names that might not seem that way at first, I guess. But I wanted to write a poem about how I felt about my name and where it came from, according to my mom, and how much it means to me as a person and as a people, African American, with like the stereotype of names that just cannot be pronounced. So yeah, I performed that, and then the second round I performed a piece called Waves, which is about literally a painting in my house of the ocean, but sort of what it's meant for me over the years and how, you know, it's grown for me. Sounds pretty boring when I talk about it, but
I don't want to put you on the spot. I mean, we won't do that.
Because
you guys just performed. But Sajari, same question to you. I mean, I guess the first thing I want to know is, why did you get involved?
Okay. Why did I get involved? I think it just started off, well, my mom is the coach of my team, and they've been competing in Louder Than a Bomb since it started. And I just think always being around so many people who have stories to tell and who tell their stories and aren't afraid, it just made me, like, eager to tell my story, you know what I'm saying? And I think this time specifically, out of, like, my 5 years doing this, I feel like this was my most, like, just telling my story, you know what I'm saying, with this poem called These, which I did about, like, all the hyper-masculinity in my life, especially because, you know, I'm a more feminine male, you know what I'm saying, and always just, you know, going through that as a young boy, you know, even with parents and family, you know, just sort of just trying to erase that stereotype and that stigma of, oh, this is a man. So I think I was just very excited this year to be able to tell that story on such a dope stage.
Okay, let's talk about you. 15 years old. What got you involved in this festival?
Well, it was definitely my coach, Belwar, because I was taking one of his classes in creative writing. And literally at the end of the school year, I was ready to, like, just done with everything. And I write this one piece about, like, my middle school experience and how that was a very bad experience. And he found me and he's like, this is a really good piece and I'd really like you on my team. And it was like one of those times where I felt so connected and like loved to all of these people who had so many things to say and were willing to hear what I wanted to say. So that's how I got involved, because my teacher was like, yo, dope poem.
Well, you know, and we hear this, Jamila. We hear, you know, my teacher, my coach, things like that. I mean, we're talking about Louder Than a Bomb has really integrated itself into the schools, into the Chicago Public Schools. You know, you've been able to bring out not just the students who come in, but the curriculum and the coaches and the teachers all want to be a part of it as well.
Yeah, that's exactly true. We have a bunch of curriculum we've developed, and really shout out to all the CPS teachers, all the teaching artists who organize and coach all the teams. It's really about the work that they do every day, you know, in the classrooms and, you know, kind of recruiting people who they see. And that was my experience, too. I actually was in a team that wasn't connected to my school. I found my school to be a kind of environment where I felt really invisible. And I think being around LTAB was the first time I really felt seen. And I think that's a lot of the work that we do, is allowing young people a platform to speak to their identities in their own words.
For you, did you consider yourself an artist or a poet before Louder Than a Bomb? Did you enter in going, I'm a poet and I need a place to learn how to do this? Or did the writing exercises and the just getting involved, did it say, oh, I could do this?
I actually didn't consider myself a poet. I always loved singing. I signed up for a program around singing, and I actually got put into a poetry program, and I was really mad. but then I ended up loving it and found Louder Than a Bomb, and through that became way more confident in my voice than I ever was with singing. I kind of didn't think I could ever be a singer until I found poetry, and people were like, wow, like, your approach is different, like you're quiet, like you're this or you're that, and it was appreciated, versus I always kind of thought of it as a negative. So through poetry, I think that has given me more confidence as a performer, as a singer in general.
Let me ask that same question to you guys. The idea of, you know, when you were approached by your teacher, or you were involved in classes, or you were, you know, you were on teams, did you consider yourself, you know, I want to be a writer, so I'm going to get involved with training to be a writer? Or did this project, did Louder Than a Bomb and all the things that are happening in your school, did it draw it out of you?
Okay, so I started writing way back when I, like, first few things I did in this country was, like, learn how to write. So writing has always been a huge part of me, but I've never, like, expressed myself through the writing. Maybe I'd, like, explain, like, a sunset or something, but never just, like, talk about who I am as a human being. So I think LTAP definitely drew, like, me personally to my writing, but I was always, like, a writer. I always liked the act of writing.
Where are you from?
Uganda.
How long have you been in Chicago?
7 years.
Okay. All right, what do you think, guys?
I think for me, I started off, like, dancing. And, like, I've always loved the stage, you know what I'm saying? And I, witnessing poetry was just, like, a different form of telling your story to me. And it was just so powerful that I really wanted to do it, you know what I'm saying? Because I think performing arts in general is just such a beautiful thing. You know, it gives you a voice, it gives you a story. So I think poetry, for me, is one of the best arts to have your voice be heard. And I think that idea of just being heard is what gravitated me towards.
Yeah, I completely agree. I was a writer before I got fully immersed in Louder Than a Bomb, because I was writing before, like, the age limit and the age requirement to be in Louder Than a Bomb. But what drew me to it was not that I wanted to be the writer and I wanted to be the person on the stage. I was just drawn to everyone's stories and, like, hearing people express themselves in these awesome ways, because you can walk down the street and express yourself, and you can speak to someone and express yourself, but when you get on the stage and it's something that started out so personal and now it's so public, it's just really beautiful to watch a person get on a stage. And just,
yeah, and I would say, I mean, have you guys, what have you learned about this experience? I mean, getting up on stage and being able to think, take thoughts and ideas that were very private and make it public. What have you learned? What has Louder Than a Bomb done for you as artists? I mean, when you're done with this now, and, I mean, you're never done with it, but when you're done, I mean, what's the takeaway, especially from this year?
I think for me, there's so many things that it provides. It provides, you know, it provides a career that you might think you want to do. It provides beautiful relationships. It provides family. You know what I'm saying? It provides just, like, love, you know, which is always needed, you know. I guess the list goes on.
That's true.
You know?
Yeah.
Charlotte, what do you think?
What was the question again?
A question of, like, going through the whole process, this festival, everything, coming out on top. I mean, you're a finalist. What did you learn from this? What has Louder Than a Bomb done to enhance your art?
everyone is so amazingly nice. That is one of the things I've learned, that it's not really a competition anymore. It's just us going and watching each other. And I've learned so much about so many different people and so many different cultures. There's just so many stories to be told. Mm-hmm. And it's just so beautiful just going up on stage and just hearing someone from like a completely different background, completely different life, and just have them share your stories. And I think that one of the best things I've learned is the stories of the people. Like, and just like, I have all those people on Snapchat, so like I can always like hang out with them. So like, it's an amazing, yeah. Just all these relationships and all these stories. It's overwhelmingly like amazing.
Yeah, it's proved that, you know, our existence isn't in vain. Like, everyone's here for a reason. Everyone has a story. And I think, like Sajari said, that's the big thing of just knowing that you have a story and that your story is valid no matter what it contains, and that people can hear it. And you're not the only one. Like, you're the only one you, but there are so many others that can look at you and see you, and that's all that matters.
I mentioned at the beginning, Jamila, just the concept of, you know, the alumni of Louder Than a Bomb. Mm-hmm. And there's something about this festival, Young Chicago Authors, that is attracting artists and training to the stage, to the spoken word. And you're seeing, you know, even a generation above, you know, everybody that's in the studio, you and Chance and, you know, Mick Jenkins down the line, starting to have professional careers mm-hmm. in the arts. Talk about that, because that's next. I mean, at some point, you know, the people who are involved in Loud and a Bomb, they become the next generation, the next community of artists that are in Chicago.
Yeah, and I think that's really true, kind of like what Sejai was speaking to, with seeing a pathway for yourself beyond high school, beyond Louder Than a Bomb. And Louder Than a Bomb is actually run by majority of a teaching artist corps that's very young, a lot of them who are alumni of Louder Than a Bomb. And I think for me, it was a lot of unlearning what a real job looks like mm-hmm. and what it is. And I think I went to college and I had a lot of ideas in my head about what I should be doing. But at the end of the day, I think it was that feeling, kind of like what Charlotte's describing, what they're all saying about what am I passionate about. And I think being able to have the opportunity to discover that is something that Louder Than a Bomb gives a lot of people. And then once you have that, it's addicting. I think it's a privilege to be able to pursue that, but I also believe everyone should be able to.
Well, I got to have you back because, you know, we're out of time. It's 10 o'clock. Mm-hmm. And I want to talk to you about your singing career, because we have, you know, we're talked about Louder Than a Bomb tonight. But, you know, you've released music. You're continuing to work not only in music, but in poetry. Jamila Woods is the Associate Artistic Director at Young Chicago Authors and helps organize the festival, the Louder Than a Bomb Festival, which is, go ahead.
And I just wanted to say, I'll be performing on Saturday, because we're having our theme for Saturday finals is Black Girl Magic.
Okay.
So I'll be performing alongside Aaron Allen Kane, Darren Alexis, and some other poets. So hopefully everyone will come check out.
So there'll be performances. This will be Saturday night at the Auditorium Theater, Louder Than a Bomb, the team part of the festival. The individuals were tonight at the DuSable Museum. We have the finalists in studio. Is it Irion?
Yeah.
I got Irion Roche, Sajari Villegas, Charlotte Namakule. No?
Namakula.
Namakula. I'm missing on the A at the
end. It's all good.
Namakula.
You're good.
No, it's not good. It's unacceptable. Namakula. All right. Thank you, guys. Congratulations
on being
finalists, and thanks for coming on the show tonight. I know it was tough. You were at the show, and you got over here, so thank you. We appreciate it.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having us.
It's a download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman with you till 11 o'clock. And Patty's taking over. Patty Vasquez with Pretty Late with Patty Vasquez up at 11 o'clock till 2. Well, the Flower and Garden Show wraps up this weekend out at Navy Pier. The show features gardeners, vendors, florists, landscapers, you name it. Anything that has to do with planting, and it's there. It's a staple in Chicago, of course. And joining me now to talk more about this great show, festival, whatever you want to call it, Tony Abruscato. He's the president and show director of the Chicago Flower and Garden Show. He's been running it for the past decade or so, but the show dates back to 1847?
1847. We're one of the oldest in the country and obviously the oldest event in the city.
That's amazing. I mean, I had no idea it had that kind of history.
Most people don't. And you know, we did some research. We looked back, and that's really where the roots of it come from. And it was the Chicago Fruit and Flower Show. fresh fruit back in 1847. That's pre-Civil War, pre-Lincoln. You know, the fresh fruit was a big deal. How do you get it into a major city, right, and how do you move it around? So that's what it's about. And that's what we do now, try to stay relevant.
That's it's amazing to think about the history of the of going back that far. But, I mean, one of the things I've always loved about the Flower and Garden Show is it really is a place that if you want to get into gardening, and that is something that right now in March people want to get into gardening, right, it's a great place to go.
Absolutely. You know, we're geared all toward education and inspiration. So the idea is you can come to the Flower and Garden Show if you don't know about gardening, and there's tons of people to talk to about learning about gardening. We have all kinds of workshops and seminars. Today we were doing our container gardening class. We have Tu Bloom, who does the containers on the red carpet at the Grammy Awards, and he does all of our container gardening classes. So he'll actually walk you through the process of how to care for it, how to plant it, create the frame of the new thing right now is thriller, filler, and spiller.
Okay.
And so that's how you do all your containers. And so that's what we want people to do.
So when you say container gardening, that's the kind of stuff for more urban environments where you may not have the space to do a garden in the backyard?
Absolutely. But what we're finding too is even in some of the large suburban spaces, people are doing small vignettes. So they might do an area that's vegetables. They might do an area that's containers, or they'll have a patio. And so container gardening is really transcending even out of the urban space and into the suburban. But typically like on a balcony or something like that, containers are perfect.
Do you find yourself with I've been to the Chicago Flower and Garden Show a couple times. I remember Kathy and Judy doing remotes from out, right, there. I mean, I remember it being sort of like a place that, and I don't mean to date anybody or put anything, that it was for my mom. Like, my mom was a big gardener. She would be out to that thing, and it had to feel that, like, you would pick up some tips or you'd pick up a flower or whatever. Have you seen is that the right demographic? I mean, have you seen demographics shift in recent time?
Well, we've made actually a conscious effort to shift our demographic, but being very careful to make sure that we maintain mom and grandma, right, right, at the show. But what we've done is we really focused a lot on the next generation of gardener. And in a lot of cases, that's the young kids. But also, you can be 50 and a new gardener. You don't have to be a young kid. But we look at cultivating the next generation of gardeners. So we've developed really a big kids' activity garden. We have 9 free activities a day for kids to participate, from a bug zoo to the British International School's doing a program where the kids can design and create their own biodegradable flower pot and then plant it with a lettuce plant and take it home with them. They have an art project. They have a lot of different things.
That used to be what you did like in first grade, like in kindergarten, right? You got to plant. You
know, right? Exactly. Listen, it all goes back to being new. And so here we are. These kids, they're wrapping newspaper.
That's
and
where I would
lettuce.
Be. I'd be in the kids thing with them making my little thing to be able to take home and be like, I'm a gardener. Look.
Yeah. And it's a great thing. And so we gear all this thing for kids. So now we're seeing a lot more young families coming in, and also people understanding that, you know, these are true gardens. So we have koi ponds and we have waterfalls, right, and pergolas and all kinds of things in the backyard. It's not your grandmother's prize rose on a table.
You know what? Let's we got to take a break to keep on schedule here. But I really want to talk about the uptick in people wanting to be organic.
Right.
Are you seeing much more emphasis on knowing where your food comes from, a more farm-to-table approach? And that sort of translates to gardening and flowers as well, as to understand, you know, how you can be environmentally friendly, how you can be part of this planet. And I want to talk about what the efforts you're doing at the Flower and Garden Show, you know, to make that happen. We'll talk with Tony Abruscata, who is the president and show director of the Chicago Flower and Garden Show, which is running through this weekend at Navy Pier. We'll take a quick break. We'll be right back. It's a download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman, talking flowers, talking gardens, talking the Chicago Flower and Garden Show. In studio with me, Tony Abruscato. He is the president and show director of the Chicago Flower and Garden Show, which he doesn't date back to 1847, but he's been there for about a decade. What have you seen? What changes have you seen in your time there? I mean, a decade of running the Chicago Flower and Garden Show. What's been the biggest change?
You know, a couple of different changes. One being that shift to the younger demographic that we were talking about, bringing in young families. The other shift has been The more practical side of gardening. And so we're putting in practical displays. And then the other is the shift to organics, growing your own food and edibles and really focusing in on that, and people coming in and saying, I want to know about vegetable gardening.
Are people asking? I mean, is that a big thing when it comes to shows, flower and garden shows, where they're having to change because of the trends, this farm-to-table trend, organic trends, things like that?
Absolutely. And that's the thing. We need to keep pace or you know, help the public with the pace so that we look at what's trending out there and where are we going. And so focusing in on edibles and organics, we have our gardening, we have a garden gourmet stage. And so we bring in top chefs from around the city and they're talking about farm to table. They're talking about growing your own food. And that's why, you know, somebody asked me the other day, they're like, why do you have a cooking stage at the flower show? And it's all about lifestyle. So people are growing their own food and they're cooking that food.
Right.
And so we want to make sure those
chefs
are there.
Well, shows like yours, I mean, because you're going to have, you know, all summer long here in Chicago, you're going to have a lot of different, you know, everything from Taste of Chicago to the farmers markets. There's really an emphasis on that. But shows like the Flower and Garden Show, are you guys like a houseware show where you're the trendsetter that you know, the things that are happening in flowers and gardens and planting, they're sort of like, here's almost like the car show is, you know,
right.
Is it the same concept?
It's the same concept. You know, it's interesting in the flower community, it takes a year or two for things to come out. So what we're actually doing at times, like right now we have, five new tulips that are coming out. They're brand new. Their first time they're being seen is at the Chicago Flower and Garden Show. We have three varieties of hyacinths and a bunch of roses that have never been seen before. But those actually were introduced to the industry last year. But it takes that long for those plants to grow and for everything to come in. So we're actually showing, in some ways, last year's new introductions, but they're new to the public this year. And so we try to follow that.
I mean,
trend.
That's a big, I mean, you really have to, it's a different kind of cycle because, you know, you can't, like a car can be manufactured, but you have to wait for the flower to bloom, to come to, you know, to be a flower.
Right. Absolutely. And so, and what we don't want to do too much is have a flower and say, oh, here's this flower in March and it's going to be available in a year and a half from now.
Right.
So we want to do what's coming up in the spring. And so we follow those trends. I travel around, not too extensively, but I travel around the country. I go to different shows, industry shows where it's a grower to grower, you know, kind of business to business, and see what they're doing, bring them in. This year we have 9 different plant growers involved in the show, which is one of the first times ever. And so we've got a lot of plant material and we have a lot of new plant material.
You know, is there, I mean, I'm... Forgive my ignorance, you know, to when you say you travel around to shows, grower to grower. I mean, there's a flower and garden show in every big city in America?
Most. We've got the Philadelphia Flower Show, which is the largest in the country. That dates back to 1827. Yeah. So they got us a little bit there. But then there's one in Seattle and San Francisco. There's a Cincinnati Flower Show. But really, Philadelphia, Chicago, Northwest tend to lead the way in those bigger shows. But it's, you know, a terrific way for people to come out and see what's happening. And they've been going on for so long. It's just amazing.
It's amazing how many people go out there. I mean, I worked at Navy Pier for 20 years and I feel like when it was Flower and Garden Week, you know, or the 2 weeks or whatever it is, it was just chaos. There were so many people trying to park and things like that. You know, I'm interested in, like, do you have to count on the vendors and the gardeners and the people that are displaying in the show to be ahead of the curve? I mean, do you have to monitor that as the people who are running the show to be like, if somebody's coming in every week and they're like, I've got, you know, grass that will not die, and you're like, that's so 1995, man.
Right.
You need to, like, you know, like, I mean, do you have to almost monitor and make sure that the vendors are in the spirit of the Chicago Flower and Garden Show?
We try to do that, you know, and we're broken up in different sections. So we have 20 plus gardens that are there. So that I talked about earlier, the koi ponds and the waterfalls and everything. So you have the garden side, and then you have like the vendor side, the marketplace area. And so with ours, we have a little bit of home and garden.
Mm-hmm.
We also have some items that are female centric. So we try to bring in as much gardening and greening as we can, but we also we're 70% female. And so sometimes, you know, bringing in, we have somebody that does jewelry that's in the shape, you know, shape of flowers or some different things or different products that relate back to that demographic. But we really strive to try to bring in that garden person. And we're looking at now, we were talking about earlier, the organic.
Yeah.
So we're bringing in some of the organic soil companies that are there, bringing in the seed companies that are heirloom seeds.
Let me ask you, because as we wrap up here, you know, as you look forward to 5, 10 years, 15 years into the business, and you've been doing this for 10 years, right?
Yeah.
But thinking ahead, because you see in California a water shortage, you know, that is highly, you know, you see sort of regulations from the state in terms of how people can, you know, use water to
right.
water their lawns and things like that. Do you see gardening and flowers and but mostly gardening moving in a direction that there has to be more environmental concern for the planet and for the resources that we have?
Absolutely. And it's one of, you know, we have a couple of gardens, one designed by the Lurie Garden that's here in Millennium Park. And it's all about natives and naturals and sustainable plants, because they require, one, they require less maintenance. Two, they require less water. And so people are focusing on those types of plants. And then also looking at, you know, some of the lawn areas, replacing some of those lawn areas that take so much water. And, you know, back in the day, you'd come out with, you know, chemicals and you'd be fertilizing and doing all of these things. And so now it's how can we bring in these native plants and natural plants? And one of the things that we'll be showing at the 2017 show is how those native plants would work in a contemporary setting. So everyone thinks about native plants as kind of, you know, a log cabin and prairie, and they're all bushy and everything else. But one of the things we're looking to do at the 2017 is show them in a contemporary setting.
There you go. We got a scoop.
You got a
right
scoop.
At the end, the 2017 Flower and Garden Show. Tony Abruscato is the president and show director of the Chicago Flower and Garden Show. It runs through this weekend at Navy Pier. He's been running the show for about the past decade. Tony, thanks for talking flowers and gardens with us tonight in a download.
Oh, thanks so much for having me in. I appreciate it.
Welcome back to The Download here on WGN Radio with you till 11 o'clock tonight. Patty Vasquez takes over at 11 with Pretty Late with Patty Vasquez. I'm Justin Kaufman. Tomorrow night, the new film Creative Control makes its Chicago debut at the Music Box. It's the second feature film from Wheaton-raised Benjamin Dickinson. That sounds weird to me. Wheaton-raised. We'll talk about that.
I'm like cattle.
Benjamin,
I'm very
also,
lean.
You're very lean. You look nice. Yeah. Benjamin also stars in the movie, which explores relationships, technology, technology's effect on relationships, all through the eyes of the main character, David, of course, played by Benjamin Dickinson. The movie played South by Southwest last year and is being distributed by Magnolia Pictures. The writer, director, and star, Benjamin Dickinson, is with me tonight. Nice to meet you. Great,
what up, Chicago?
Great film, yeah.
Thank you.
So Wheaton-raised, let me talk there, because in the pitch, they're like, you know, Benjamin spent so much time coming down to see films at the Music Box, and now he's got his film at the Music Box.
Is
that true?
It's really surreal, actually, and I want to travel back in time and say hello to my 16-year-old self who's riding, you know, riding Metro out here to watch Spike and Mike's, you know, Twisted,
right.
Sick and Twisted Animation Festival, and like be like, by the way, your own film would be playing here in 10 years. I'd be like, get out of here, old man.
I mean, you ever think about that? I mean, you know, as you're putting films together, you're like, oh, it's just going to look great on the Music Box screen.
you know what? I was in too much pain and fear while I was making the film to
really
think about that. Yeah, I mean, making a film is the worst. I wouldn't recommend it to anybody.
Okay, I'm going to follow up on that because, I mean, I want to talk all about the movie. It's a great movie.
Okay.
But yeah, I mean, this is – you can tell this film is made by someone who really respects the art of filmmaking. I mean, there's a lot of slow motion shots. There's a lot of really, really spectacular artistic shots in this film. What – the process of making a film, it terrifies you?
No, it doesn't terrify me. It's just really difficult and painful. And I don't think there's any way out of that, especially production. And by the way, it's nice that you say respect, because some reviews call those slow motion shots indulgent. I believe the word preening was used. Show off, I believe, was also used in a review. So I like your interpretation.
You're good. You can use it on the back of the DVD.
Yeah, I don't know if there's a certain point like where I don't know if there's a threshold of budget where it becomes more comfortable. But you know, no matter what, it's so expensive to make a film. You're always rushing against time. There's never enough time. There's never enough money. So the actual production is usually it's tough, you know?
It's
tough.
I guess people think about it. It's such a passion play to be a filmmaker. I mean, you're playing with, you're doing everything from your heart. You're putting heart and soul into it. But it is something that at the actual moment of putting it together and shooting it, there's a lot of stress.
Yeah, it's not sleeping and, you know, waking up at 5 a.m. and then, you know, you lose your location and the actor's got nerves. I mean, it's really problem solving at the point. There's a lot of creativity that goes into it, but creativity in the sense of problem solving is sort of the main skill.
You're, you know, the co-writer, your director, you're the star in the movie. I mean, that has to add to the stress as well.
Yeah, that was a really bad idea. I don't know. I don't know. Yeah. I don't know if I would do that again.
Why?
Just because it's literally just time and having to switch back and forth between being the captain of the ship and then being an actor. And especially in this movie, because it's like, you know, I'm kind of running the show all day. And then it's like, okay, guys, now in this scene, I'm going to be masturbating, you know. So that's not a spoiler.
You just spoiled the whole movie.
I did.
No.
You know, so it's weird to be so vulnerable that an actor needs to be and try to be emotionally naked and then to go back into the role of, like, steering the ship. It's difficult. It's like schizophrenic, kind of.
Is it hard motivation-wise for you as an actor? Because you have to rely on other people on the set to say, okay, are you ready, Benjamin? Here's what we're going to do. Are you pretty much having that talk with yourself internally?
I mean, I'd already – you know, I wrote the movie, so right. I felt like I was inside the character's head already. That didn't mean that I always knew that I was connecting and I would have to talk to the DP or my editors were on set sometimes or sometimes the other actors would give me feedback. You know, it's always a team effort. So there was plenty of other creative people on set that I trusted enough that if I wasn't making it happen, it wasn't like they wouldn't tell me.
Do you consider yourself – I mean, this is your film.
Yeah.
You wrote it. You directed it. You starred in it. Is there one that you feel you're more comfortable in the role than the others?
I think I'm most comfortable in the role of writing because it's just me, like, isolated from society, you know, like in a little room somewhere, just me and my imagination, you know. So I think that's where I'm most comfortable. Yeah, the other two are – I mean, I think I actually have the most experience as a director. That's where I feel the most confident. And then acting, that was just
– Well, let's take it in chunks. Let's talk about the writing because this story – is a story that, I mean, we, you know, you rip from the headlines kind of thing where the story is really about technology. The character is an advertising exec who pitches and successfully gets a company who is essentially Google Glass, like the idea of eyewear. And then the character has to try it out. It's just an interesting way that, you know, to get into the idea of a movie about this sort of adaptive augmented technology.
Yeah, I think you know, part of the reason that I wanted to have the main character be an early adopter of the movie is that I wanted to show that I think that there's an intersection point, a confluence of pressures that result at the intersection of technology, marketing, advertising, capitalism, and drugs that's happening. So the movie isn't about a world where everyone's augmenting their reality.
Absolutely, right.
It's kind of about how one character is turning up the amplification on augmenting his reality, and he's doing it in a lot of different ways, not just with the technology.
It's funny because I thought about that because I think Reggie Watts has a line later just about augmenting, and there really is this feel that the character, as it evolves through the movie, really you start to lose track of what's real and what's not.
Right.
And that's what technology, whether it's glasses or your phone or whatever it is, that's truly what's happening almost every day in our society.
I think it's happening to a lot of us, and some people are getting super lost and we don't know about them, like they're falling off the edge of the earth. I mean, yeah, I don't want to get down, but we have an opioid epidemic going on in this country. I think there's a mental health crisis going on in this country. We're more medicated than ever. Mm-hmm. And on top of that, serious internet addiction, pornography addiction, all this stuff. So I think people are losing touch with reality. And those are extreme cases I'm mentioning. I think the majority of people who are just living their lives, they even feel it creeping in. And it's an anxiety that I feel around me. And I don't know that we know how to talk about it.
Right.
You know what I mean? A little bit. Or we feel that it's happening, but we're supposed to just pretend that we're not anxious about it. But I'm anxious about it. And making the movie, I found that many people are.
I mean, entertainment and art in has always been sort of a conversation starter. I mean,
I think it gives a context for people to talk about stuff that they were feeling, but they didn't have a context or didn't feel comfortable talking about it. And once you get it out there in art, then it's like a release valve. And people can be like, okay, this is something that I can, that we can talk about. And now it's, you know, it's.
And it's not just about the obsession with the technology, but it was about the technology's obsession and its impact on the relationships of these characters, because there were four main characters, if you will. There were probably some more around that. But it was about how technology was affecting them. One was a photographer who was really into sharing everything, including his sexual exploits.
Right.
The other was the advertising exec, and then there was the two girlfriends who both, you know, were, I mean, I want to, and I'll ask you about this next, but it just seemed to me like everything that was happening in technology was having an impact on just the basic relationships.
I think absolutely it's true, and like in the case of Wim, the photographer, there's almost like an oversharing with technology. And then David uses it to isolate. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? So like it goes in all these different extreme areas. I think what happens with technology, well, especially in the internet, in this virtual world, is that suddenly we're in a world where consequences are different. And that's why you can have people be trolls on Twitter. And then in regular life, they're a normal socialized person. But somehow in this sort of vacuum where there doesn't seem to be consequences, people can become vicious. So I think that's interesting. It's almost like we're reaching a point of like pure psychic energy level where it's just the id and the superego fighting it out in virtual space.
Well, you know, that's what I was going to say about, you know, the comparisons in the movie. You know, the David's girlfriend, Juliet. She's big into yoga.
Yeah.
And there is this this emphasis on, you know, I think early on, like, you know, keep the electronics out of here. Like,
yeah.
This is about connecting your mind, your body, your spirit.
Yeah.
It's almost like the yin to the yang of what's going on with David. That's on purpose.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, even in the earlier drafts, the movie was really like a David-Juliet comparison back and forth, and they had an equal number of scenes. That works in a novel, but in a movie, because it's linear, you kind of need like it to be lopsided. And we even cut out maybe five Juliet scenes. In a way, it's unfortunate, but it was too long.
But she's still a big part of it. That's a big part of her world.
It's a big part of it, and
in a strange way, comes to the same conclusions at the end of the movie that the main character, David, comes through with using the technology.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think the more that we become more virtual, the more we're going to need to strategize ways to get back into our bodies, because in the foreseeable future, we're stuck in these meat sacks, man. I mean, as much as we want to just be totally creative, imagined, as much as we love to live in a world of concept, as far as we know, consciousness is totally tied to being in a body. I mean, we have the Cartesian anxiety in Western society. I think, therefore I am. Mm-hmm. Descartes says that. And the implication is that consciousness is separate from being embodied. But we have no idea if that's true. We haven't been able to reanimate a body.
Mm-hmm.
So
and this time that we're living in right now is testing that.
It is. Yeah. And I mean, I don't know either, but
you're an avatar. You're a little picture on Twitter. You're not an actual person, but you have thoughts.
And yet you are. Fundamentally, you know, we're still living in the same bodies our ancestors had 200,000 years ago. So I think we're going to need to get hip to the fact that we got to take care of these bodies, and like our basic needs for touch and community and closeness and intimacy, that's not going away. So I think the more the technology becomes virtual, the more we're going to have to like really – and I think it's interesting. You know, guys like David Lynch are trying to get meditation into schools. Mm-hmm. Like I think you do see a refocus on just the health of the body necessarily. And I think we got to keep going in that direction. I think we got to really think about how we can take care of our needs as mammals. And I mean, this extends to everything, because like one of our biggest needs as mammals is to not have a polluted planet. I'm sorry. You know what I mean? But like, you know, at some point we're just going to have to be like, wait a second, we need to breathe the air. We need to drink the water. Like we have to start making different choices than just profit, which is why it was important to me to have it take place in the world of advertising.
You know, for you as a filmmaker, I mean, like you said, we just talk about why you made this film or wrote this film. The film and the actual production of the film, we talked a little bit at the top just about the creativity that you put into the shot, but you made conscious choices like to make it black and white.
Yeah.
You made a conscious choice. The music I thought was very conscious about it being Baroque. This concept of everything was classic, and it was juxtaposed against a world that in the synopsis you write takes place 5 minutes into the future.
Yeah. Well, I think we're always returning, you know, there's kind of like a cyclical aspect. I think Baroque music evokes luxury. It actually evokes superficiality in a way, because it's all about the style. And that time in Europe is very ornate and black, and you know, they're living in black and white spaces. It's kind of like a luxury ad a little bit. This idea that you could be living in a beautiful classical environment and that it would be a hellscape. And me, that's part of the tension of the movie.
And also, like, it seemed like the juxtaposition against the idea that technology is I mean, way beyond what any of those any of those mediums, the music Baroque or the black and white, could ever imagine.
I guess I thought of the problems, the human problems, as being classical. you know what I mean?
That's right, that's right.
Yeah, it's still kind of the same thing. Like, you're trying to get along with your maid and communicate.
Well, it's a great movie, and it's at the Music Box Theater up on Southport in, I guess you call that Wrigleyville? Like, is that around that time? Lakeview, Wrigleyville?
I used to call it Lakeview back in my day.
Yeah, there you go. Are you excited? Are you going to be
there?
I'm
really excited. I'm going to be there to do Q&As Friday and Saturday after, like, the 7 o'clock show, and then I'll introduce the late show. I think there'll be a moderator. So, I mean, in the introduction won't be as in-depth Q&A, but yeah, I'll be there. I'll be there to talk to everybody and hopefully see some...
You get up on that stage,
hopefully,
right?
See some old buddies, old Chicago buddies.
Yeah, that's good. Yeah. Benjamin Dickinson is the writer, director, and star of the movie Creative Control, which will be on stage or on screen at the Music Box.
And honestly, I'm going to actually act out the film. It's like Rocky Horror Picture Show. So come out for that.
A cottage industry, man. You can just do that afterwards. Just tour the world. Yeah. Benjamin, thanks for being here.
Yeah, it was a pleasure.
All right, that's going to do it tonight for The Download. We are off tomorrow night as the Blackhawks play. And we'll be back Monday night with a great show. Natalie Moore, her book Southside. Also, I mean, this, I guess we could say, but the guys from Oh Hello will be on the program. That we're working that out as we speak. That's Nick Kroll and John Mulaney. And much, much more. We'll play The Worst, and we'll also have some live music. It's a great show. And next week, I believe, we've got some show Monday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. That's what we have, right? I think so. Tuesday's off. Anyway, you know what? We got shows next week, which is good.